adopt it, or is the laundry list of that?
What's the order?
All right, today's date is May 13th, 2019, Tom Bell, 1:05 PM. My name is Michael Sonner, I'm the chairman of the Ocala Police Department, Police Retirement System. I will call the order of the May 13th meeting of the Board of Trustees. We'll start with my right, where everybody will introduce themselves for purposes of the recording.
Steve Cuffey, Secretary for Board.
Lenny Epigraph, Board Member.
Doug Nelson, Foster Foster Actuary.
Mindy Stewart, Board Member.
Brian Kriegel, Board Member.
Larry Cole, Investment Consultant.
Alicia Gaither.
Jessica Fowlerin.
Dale Adams, Plan Administrator.
All right, first item on the agenda is review of the minutes of the two prior meetings. That would be the February 11th regular meeting and the April 23rd special meeting. Has anybody had a chance to review those minutes?
Yes.
Does anybody wish to make a motion to accept them?
Make a motion to accept the minutes.
Second. Any discussion? All in favor of accepting the meeting from the prior two meetings?
Aye.
All right, next item will be Mr. Christensen's attorney's report.
Okay, do you want me to talk about board business before I talk about the representation issue? I think that's part of the agenda, right? So let me do the lawyer stuff.
Okay.
All right, first of all, reminder for the trustees, the financial disclosure forms are due on July the 1st. And so we want, you should be getting those in the mail, but I suspect maybe Dale keeps track of that. And if anybody doesn't get that form, remember, even if you don't get it in the mail, you still have to file it. So please be sure to file that by July 1st. And if I'm there or still doing your work by July 1st, your next meeting, if anybody hasn't filed the form, I'll give you another reminder. Remember, there is a fine that starts on September 1st, so we don't want anybody paying any fines. So please be sure to file the form. Next item I've got is what I call the Internal Revenue Code ordinance. I think you have a copy of that. Do you all have that in front of you?
I have a copy of it here. We don't have copies for all the board members.
Okay, well, what this ordinance is intending to do is to obviously make a couple of changes that are sort of dictated by Internal Revenue Code and for regulations or guidance from the IRS. And, but it does a couple of other things as well. One of the things that it does is it makes a change to the disability section in our plan document to clarify the provisions that we currently have in there for situations where somebody terminates employment for whatever reason. And the reason why we made this change, it isn't intended to change the intention of the provision that we currently have in the plan. And so basically, the reason why we're doing what we're doing is because I actually had a case down in Fort Myers where a judge reviewed the language that we had in the plan. And it was his opinion anyway that the language didn't say what we said it said. And so as a result, I came back and I rewrote the section regarding eligibility for disability benefits. And I made it, in my view, crystal clear as to what the rules are with regard to anybody who terminates their employment and their right to receive a disability benefit. Okay? Any questions about that? Dale, you've looked at this, so if you have any questions, maybe you can feel free to talk.
Yeah, I looked over it. Lee had already summarized it before what he was going to do at the previous meeting. And I looked over it.
Is it not worth me going through the section at a time? I mean, if the board's comfortable with it, what we ultimately want to do is get the board to approve this and direct me to send it to the city for consideration and adoption.
Five changes? If you want to go ahead and summarize it.
One of the changes was the missing benefit recipient language that basically contemplates that if we find ourselves with somebody that we can't find, it specifically has a procedure which the IRS has promulgated, and we will put in our operating rules that essentially sets forth what we need to do to try to find those missing benefit recipients. We also took out some language in the drop that we didn't need. It had to do with the cheat, and the cheat is basically what happens if you can't find somebody. So we took out that language because we were putting in the IRS missing benefit of recipient language. And then the last change that we made in this ordinance is to clarify and update our rules for reemployment after retirement. We realized when we sent it to the tax attorney and they reviewed it, they observed that we had rules for someone who comes back to employment after they retired under normal retirement. We also had rules for what happens if somebody comes back if they leave under early retirement, but we really didn't have any rules for what happens if somebody comes back if they've gone out on disability retirement. So what we've done here is we've added additional language that gives the specific rules that are associated with somebody who's reemployed by the city if they've gone out on disability retirement. So that's kind of a IRS compliance change to the reemployment after retirement section. So that's in a nutshell what we're proposing to do. If y'all want to approve this, fine. If you want to further look at it, that's fine as well. But ultimately, my recommendation is that we send it to the city for consideration and adoption.
Does it substantially change anything, or is this all administrative stuff?
I wouldn't say that it substantially changes anything. Obviously, the missing benefit recipient is a new provision, and the reemployment after retirement is, you know, taking into consideration. We could rehire somebody who went out on disability retirement, and we didn't have any rules for that, so that's what we've added.
Has there been any change? I know we were told before with the Stoneman Douglas Act last year and the rehiring police officers and SROs and guardians and so on, and the schools, there was some talk about changing the statute this year to allow retired municipal officers to be rehired and not have to suspend their benefits. Do you know if any of that was addressed by the legislature?
No.
I know
there was no change in the law that dealt with that issue. Now, of course, this has to do with, and I know the SROs, sometimes they're hired by the municipality, but sometimes they're hired by the school district. So obviously, that would make a difference. But right now, if they're rehired, if they're out on retirement, they're rehired by the city, then the reemployment rules will apply. And they're IRS in the state.
I know that's a totally different topic, but I wanted to bring it up because you did have that rehire provision in this ordinance.
Sure. Any other questions? What's your pleasure?
I think it's mostly basically a housekeeping type ordinance. Isn't that right, Scott?
I think for the most part, that's probably pretty good. I'm not sure what your SOP there is, but what I would typically do if y'all approve it is I will send it to the city for adoption, the city manager and for the mayor, and send them a letter similar to the one that I sent to you, Dale, explaining what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Anybody got any questions?
I'll make a motion that we ask Scott to go ahead and submit it to the city for consideration.
Motion?
Second.
And a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Okay, so having once the city adopts this ordinance, we're going to need to do some tweaking to our operating rules to add the full procedure that the IRS has promulgated with regard to missing benefit recipients. And we actually have some other changes that we also need to make, just kind of updating the documents. So that will be sort of a preview of coming attraction.
Okay.
Anybody have any questions about that?
No, sure.
And then our summary plan description, once this ordinance gets adopted, you left the summary plan description in May of 2017. And as you're aware, that document needs to be updated every 2 years. We're making a few little changes to the plan in this ordinance. So once the ordinance is adopted, then we'll have to update the summary plan description as well. So this is for this to do anyway. We're supposed to do it every 2 years. But I think we can wait another quarter on that to see what happens with our order, and then we can update the summary plan description. Do y'all want to make a motion to authorize the updating of the summary plan description contingent on the adoption of the ordinance? Because technically it is.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
I'll make a motion that if the ordinance is passed by the city, that we authorize the attorney to go ahead and make the necessary updates to the summary plan.
Perfect.
And move to the next meeting.
Second motion. Any seconds? Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, the next item I've got is, I did, just to let you know, I think we may have talked about this, but we did a contract amendment for Foster and Foster and their actuary fees, and just to recognize the fees that y'all have kind of approved over the last couple of years, associated with the GASB changes and the requirement that they have to now file the actuarial evaluation electronically or online. They can't just send paper anymore. So I did send that to Brad Heinrich from Foster and Foster just a few days ago. And so and I copied you on that, Dale, so you should have a copy of what I sent. So you should be looking for Brad to sign that and send it to you. So we have all those fees in black and white so that when you get a bill, you can check to make sure they're charging us what they're supposed to charge.
I've got the letter and the addendum that you sent last week. I've already, Doug's here as well, and I discussed it with him before the meeting.
Okay.
He pretty much explained it to us.
Once you get the signed documents from Brad, then you can sign them there. And like I said, all it does is sort of memorialize the fees that they did charge me, but we really didn't have an addendum to their contract.
Okay.
All right, next item, the legislative session. As y'all are probably aware, the legislative session is done over with. But the good news is that the legislature didn't make any changes to Chapter 175, 185, or any other changes that you need to be concerned with. So, specifically, that's good news that the legislature is pulling with this pension plan. So, that's the essential report on the legislature. Next item, are you intending for me to be here for the whole meeting, or are you going to have me sign off once I finish my report?
That'll be up to you. When we discuss
okay.
it on the phone,
I guess I would say.
If any of the board members want you to stick around, they can tell you we can go out of order or whether we need that.
It does not make
a
problem.
Okay, the only reason I ask that is you got no visitors here today to do the actuarial evaluation. And those of y'all been on the board for a while know each time you approve an actuarial evaluation, you have to do that little drill to declare an expected rate of investment return for the next year, the next 7 years, and for the long term thereafter. So if I'm not on the line, once you approve the valuation, I need to make sure that someone reminds the board that they need to do that declaration after you get some input from the consultant. Okay?
Okay.
All right. What is the next item? What is the status of the one-time check ordinance for the retirees?
Oh, that was discussed at the last meeting, and that went to City Council back in the first week of February, I believe it was. And there was some discussion, and the city voted 3-2 against it, and so they voted.
Okay. So that's a dead issue.
That's a dead issue.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I just wanted to follow up. That's all that I had to file. And I guess the only other thing I had to talk about, unless you have any other questions for me, legally speaking, is the representation issue. And we can either do it now or I'll wait until you get to that point on the agenda.
Just get out of order at this point, and we'll go straight to that.
You want to do the update on the RFP? Is that what you're saying, Dale?
Yeah, that was.
That's my.
That was my.
All right, you want to talk about the representation?
Sure.
Yep.
Yeah, we're going to really talk about it.
Sure.
All right, well, let me, can I say a few words before you start talking about it?
Sure.
Okay, just to let you know, I think you're all well aware that, you know, we passed away back shortly after your last meeting. And if you recall, about a year and a half ago, we and I were representing about 165 at that point. And, you know, Lee's health was not as good as it used to be, and I had to admit I was getting older. So we decided to downsize our firm. And at that point, we transitioned about 60 clients to a couple of other firms in the state that do this kind of work. And so we got down to 100 clients, and so Lee and I were each doing 50. And now with Lee's passing, I have 100 clients, and I can't do 100 clients. So unfortunately, I had to make some tough decisions, some of which were associated with geography, with the thought to, you know, reducing my client load and also reducing the amount of driving that I'm doing. Obviously, Ocala being on the outside of the circle of clients that we represent, I decided that the Ocala plan is what I would like to transition. The transition and the correspondence that I sent to y'all was certainly not intended to be dictating anything to you. Just so you know, what we were trying to do was to make the process of transitioning to another lawyer as easy as possible. And so, well, like I said, the firms that we dealt with, including the, I think the Truman firm was the firm that we had recommended to you. And you know, we've worked with these firms and know them for a long time. And what we did was, when we do the transition, is we send them a list of the clients that we want to transition, along with a meeting schedule, so that they can look at those schedules and tell us whether they can accommodate the meeting schedule of the clients that we're proposing to transition. What we didn't want is just, you know, the new lawyer to come in and say, oh, we got to move the meeting. You know, all your meetings at the same time. And so we didn't want to do that. And that was one of the criteria that we had when we were, you know, making a decision on that transition. Also, the firms that we transitioned clients to, we make copies and give them a complete copy of all of the files that we have for each client, all of the records, all the way back. So they have everything we have. And that being said, we also have an agreement with those firms that we will continue to be available. You know, if there's a historical something that happens, then we can be an assistant. We will be available to discuss that with the new lawyer and help them any way we can. The other thing that we are also doing is, of course, the lawyer who takes over our client, your file, you have all the documents that we've created and amended over the years, and I'm going to continue to be practicing. So as I make changes, you know, just either IRS changes or other kind of drafting changes in the documents that we have, I routinely provide those changes as a suggestion to the lawyers that we transition clients to. Because obviously, you know, they may or may not be familiar with our documents, but I want to again make it as easy as possible for the transition and the continued representation of our transition clients. So I just want you to know that this wasn't just a situation where I told Dale, hey, we're not representing you anymore, you're on your own. You know, I was really trying to assist the board in making a smooth transition to another firm. That said, you certainly have the right, and apparently have done an RFP, and you certainly can do that, that's your right. But I just wanted you to know that I wasn't intending to usurp any decision-making powers that the board might have with regard to your representation. So hopefully everyone understands that, and I'm willing to answer any questions that anybody might have.
Well, we do appreciate the explanation, Scott. we just figured the board took the directions of that it was a good time for economies of scale and to see what was out there, do the RFP and go that route. And, you know, see who's out there, what we can do, what costs are like. You know, all the things they beat us over the head with every time something does come up in the legislature about pensions.
Absolutely. And again, like I said, I have absolutely no problem with that. I was just trying to do my part as best I could to the board just to, you know, help out as much as I could.
We certainly appreciate that.
Okay, but, well, I don't know, y'all are going to talk about the RFP. I assume you have proposals, Mr. Attorney, you're still talking about the RFP itself.
Well, we got the due date for proposals was Friday, and we did get two proposals back, and I'm not sure if we don't have the proposals in front of us. I think Alicia may have them, but we have taken a chance to look at the two other what they sent us by email.
What two firms did you get proposals from?
We got from Ron Cohen and from Fosler and Fosler.
Okay. The Fosler firm is the other firm that we did the transition clients to, so good to know. Okay. Well, I don't have any other comments unless you have any questions for me. And y'all decide whether you want me to stay on the line or not. I'm happy to stay on the line if that's the need. And by the way, you have asked that I will continue to represent your plan as we normally ask. You know, until you tell me that you've got a replacement attorney, and then we'll transition to that replacement attorney.
Okay, we appreciate agreeing to do that too. I know, like you said, you got 100 firms, 100 clients. I know you'll want to try to reduce that as much as you can.
Right, but I haven't had too many people with that. It's been your past June 1st. For the most part, most of the clients have agreed to the transition that I suggested, so that made it pretty clean. But again, I have no problem with continuing to do the work you need to have done until you find a replacement.
Okay, thank you, Scott. I think if you're available, if we could call you back if any question comes up on anything. I don't foresee that there's going to be. I know we're going to get Doug's report here in a moment. We've also got a report from one of our investment consultants today.
Okay, well, I'll keep my stuff up here in the office, and if you want to call me back, that's fine. Just a reminder, the discussion on assumed rate of return that you tabled from February, that's not the same thing as what I just talked to you about with regard to declaring the expected rate of investment.
Right.
I think there's people in the room that know what I'm talking about, and hopefully y'all will take care of that. And of course, Dale, you know, once they declare the expected rate, you do the letter to this thing. Okay?
Right.
Okay, well, I will sign off at this point and good luck to you on your search. And please let me know if anything needs to be done. And I will, I'm going to send the ordinance to the city. I assume you want me to do that. Yes. And I'll wait to hear back on your progress on the attorney transition.
Okay. All right, so you saw it.
Okay, I'll sign off here. All right. Bye. Thank you. Yeah. All right. So do we want to come back to the RFP now and get the update on that?
Yes.
Or do we want to go ahead?
Let's press through it. Since we're on the topic, our two respondents were the Fosler firm and Ron Cohen's firm. We sent it out to five firms. And Sugarman Susskind was at the general meeting this morning, and they apparently mentioned to them that they did not respond to the RFP because they had been told that previously that we wanted to hire Fosler. And I'm not sure who they heard that from, but anyway, so they did not respond. And Siphon out of Miami did not respond, and the fifth one was a firm out of Lake Worth. We didn't hear anything back from them.
Okay.
And they are in my office.
Yeah. We did get the emails back with the proposal. I reviewed both of those. I mean, honestly, either firm we went with, the Fosler and Fosler said they were, our primary point of contact with them would be Bonnie Jensen. And she's been in the business for over 20 years. And with Ron Cohen, whether you'd be Ron or Ricky.
Ricky Levy?
Ricky Levy. And they've both been doing it a long time, so honestly, never heard of Cohen. He is apparently the lead counsel for FPPTA.
I think he was. I don't know if he still is. I can't confirm that he still is, but I know he has been.
Yeah.
And both of them are good, as long as they get, well, they're both good, yeah.
And I've been to a lot of conferences. I've heard Ms. Jensen speak many times.
Yeah.
And she seems to be very confident and very knowledgeable because she's spoken at conferences. I mean, every time it's a different part of the topic. She doesn't do, because there are certain ones at the conferences that do the same speech with a little bit of update each year, but hers has always got something different added to it.
Well, my concern when I spoke to Dale just a little bit about was both of those firms are very good firms and would do a good job for you. I have no idea what their pricing is. They're both over in the firm. But I wanted to make sure that you got, they got a lot of attorneys in those firms, and I wanted to make sure you got the ones that I think are the best pension attorneys. And Ron Cohen, Ricky, and Bonnie are all good. They're all good.
What were the prices? The Fosler firm gave us a quote of $350 per hour. And I don't have it with me, but it was half time for travel time, I believe, plus expenses for copying. I think no charges for phone calls. The charges for copying and postage and so on. And the other firm was $300 an hour, and they charged 1 hour for travel time. But then they're coming from Fort Lauderdale, so they would charge for expenses and motels that they have to stay at. And the question is, do we want them to be at every meeting, or do we want to have them? They always insisted that he be at every meeting. And that's how our meeting calendar has always been basically dictated by Lee. And some of these other firms come to a meeting if you want them to come to the meeting. And if you don't, then they don't come, and they'll call in by phone, or you just call them in the morning.
Where's Bonnie Jensen?
They're in
West Palm.
West Palm or Allendale?
Allendale, yeah, a little bit south of there. South Florida.
They're all in that 3-county area.
Yeah, I think Ron is actually in Miami. Ron Cohen.
He's actually relocated. He's in Fort Lauderdale.
Either firm is a slight reduction for what we're paying for the family in stock. If I'm thinking correctly.
Yes. Christensen and Diener is currently charging us $442 an hour, and it's due to go up July 1st. Plus half time for travel time here and back, and plus all their expenses, plus the vehicle expense, plus the meal expense, plus for Lee to come to a meeting, or if Scott were to come to a meeting, it costs us about $1,100. Their cost for just a standard 2-hour meeting.
But the only saving reason that is we're splitting that.
Putting the travel cost with the general, because he represented the business.
Did general make a decision?
They did not. They're going to set up a special meeting to discuss what to do.
So especially, is there issues that people have as whether they're at the meeting or whether they think about the phone? My first impression is I don't have an issue with the phone.
No,
I don't either.
Not. In fact, no.
And we had proposed that to Lee a number of years ago, and we So if that's what you all want to do, I'll go on to represent you as I have the strategy.
Yeah, but the only thing is as if we're talking to Randy Griffin, who was on the fire board for years and years and years, and I think Alicia mentioned it at the special meeting, we got to get with them and get the script, like when we're negotiating contract, I would always return and look at Lee and go, do your thing, and he'd run through this.
Due diligence.
Yeah, the due diligence stuff, he'd run through the 8 or 10 questions or whatever they are about venue and, you know, all the little things that they agree to. Alicia, you said Randy did that, kind of off the script that he learned. I mean, we can do a lot of it where we don't meet here, and probably through the last meetings where we went file your financial disclosure forms, and there's going to be some upcoming IRS changes, and the legislature didn't do anything, and we got charged $1,100 for that. So I'm like, see, I don't care about that. I'm just wondering if if the general is going to do something and there's an economy of scale of them getting 2 clients that maybe, because, and for everybody who's been on the board for a while, what's their big thing when they go after pension? Obviously, these pensions are overloaded fees and blah, 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 blah. And I would think if there's a chance to save some money there, because from what you're saying, you work with both firms and either one would be fine.
So the meeting is now the way of doing business.
And I find it kind of hard to believe that in this day and age, the city is, this room is not equipped for Skype or one of the.
Well, maybe that's what we should add TV in.
It probably is equipped for it. I know the city manager's conference. Probably is.
I mean, if we have that ability, Skype, phone, that sort of thing, I'm fine with it. And I'm fine if we do have a phone call and we need to adjourn the meeting for 5 minutes for being able to get home with somebody to get the answer to a question, that we can get an answer in a fairly short time to where it doesn't create us constantly tabling things and constantly having to have a special meeting or something like that because we can't decide something because we can't get an answer while we're here every 3 months.
Well, just as an FYI, I have a few clients that you and I have been turning at every meeting, and they'll just call when needed. So whether you set it up on a call when needed or just plan on them being available every quarter, set the meeting date when Colin or Bonnie or whoever would be available, then I don't see any. I guess from my perspective, I'm just your investment consultant, so take this for what it's worth, right? I don't see any problem with those plans that are doing it by phone and having them when needed. I'm not aware of any issues that have come up in any of those plans that didn't get handled and they had to get handled. So. So I have several that don't have the attorney at every meeting, but most do. I would know. Probably 70% of my clients, the attorney is at every meeting. But it's kind of a board's decision.
I would say my gut instinct is that I don't see it being a large issue if they're not here. But I'm saying that as somebody who's obviously a very new board, for those of you that have been here a while, over the time period, how many times do you think it would really, boy, I'm really glad Lee was here and we needed somebody here as opposed to probably could have done business even if I phone never happened. I think that's probably a big question.
After 10 years, when I got on the board and we started expanding, when we went from just large caps and just bonds and just cash to all the things that we're in now, having Lee here when we were hiring managers, when we were interviewing managers, was a benefit. It was a benefit because he would do all due diligence. And I think it was one time I wanted a proposal where people said no and we moved them right from the get-go because they wouldn't agree with the due diligence stuff. And so that was a good thing.
But again, there's nothing that happened in that meeting, those meetings that couldn't have happened over the phone.
Exactly.
Because he asked the same question.
Yes.
And every manager, every client meeting I'm in, you know, do you accept this, we accept Florida as the, you know, the venue, blah, 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 blah. It was like a standard four or five questions he'd ask every time.
Do you acknowledge that you're a fiduciary and you acknowledge that you have jurisdiction in Marion County? And I think that might have been part of the issue, where it was not accepted in Marion County.
And that's the answer, we will set that on prior to them coming.
Exactly.
So that they know the questions and they know how to answer them.
And nine times out of ten, when I'm recommending managers to you, they've seen them before and worked with the contract before. And I'll know that too before we go in. If not, I can make a good point to, if I'm bringing you a manager that I don't think they've seen, or the attorney hasn't seen, make sure they can, we'll ask those questions before they get it, before they get to the final.
Yeah, so I can.
Yeah.
Have the answers, the same thing. Let me check the hours on.
Yeah.
Alicia, again, turning to you, because you go to all the meetings and have for years and years and years. When fire had a question, at least with the one firm we have, been answering from, could they hit that and get somebody on the phone right now?
Yes, they could. I will say though that Randy retained a lot of the knowledge. So, you know, maybe as the board's structure changes down the road, that might have to be revisited, you know, the knowledge is up here in the future. But.
I'm always shocked in our business, this guy hasn't been used more. Even somebody like Maria coming in today. Perfect, you could have more managers giving you a 10-minute update, portfolio manager sitting right there, all that kind of stuff. You know, I'll be here every quarter. I'm only an hour, 10 minutes away or whatever, but, and I, you know, I've got to be able to review the plan, but I always thought that was, I don't know why we're not using it, I guess. It'd save you a lot of money, I think, down the road.
We do negotiate fees.
Yeah, we could negotiate fees better, Maria had better fee 50%. So.
I guess it's gotta get custom travel and all that for all the different.
I used to be on that side of the business and travel.
The phone's in.
I have a 10-minute update. Get back on the phone.
Interview.
I don't have a telephone number for 10-minute update.
Do we wanna make a decision?
I would.
Yes, guys, Ben. But they pass it.
The general plan, like once or twice a year, Rose would just call in or whatever, and kind of try to.
I thought we would get at least three of the five, and I guess Sugarman just decided why bother if you've already made up your mind, you know, for the other firm, which we had, that's not gonna sound right there. That's apparently what Pedro told us in the meeting this morning, so, which surprised me. But I would suggest that you, Mike, and Alicia, take some time. Maybe I know, but I'd hate to have another special meeting, but we have another special meeting in a few weeks for that purpose. Or there's one other option. We wait, see what general does, because all of our meetings are on the same day, to see if there is some economy of scale there or some kind of savings if both plans were to hire the same lawyer to see. Hey, we're giving you a 2-for-1 here.
But certainly, like, you all vetting this out well, because I hate to see general come back and say, well, what's police doing? And we're both looking at each other wondering what the other's going to do. Because I definitely would like to give this thing a push, certainly before we get to our next meeting, that we get our attorney lined up.
No, I agree.
General has all young trustees. So
they'll do what we said?
I don't know about that. I can't speak firm for that.
So
but what? I think they'll more or less either follow the lead or look to police for some guidance.
Or when is their special meeting?
That hasn't been set up yet.
They're waiting for us to set the meeting.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I can go to their special meeting and talk to them and maybe explain some of this and get this ball rolling.
That's why Rob from the general plan
was at our special.
He was at a special meeting. One, to see how the flow worked, this, that, the other, because he is vice chair. Bernie has been on the board for years, but he is new as chair. secretary is, submitted to set the meeting, and another trustee is in the three meetings. They're all quite young.
So while we're still on the topic of attorneys, since we've talked about it here, I have gone to the training classes, I'm familiar with Bonnie, watched her speak and teach, and I do like the Closter Form, company a lot. I don't know the Cohen company, but I can tell you that, me personally, I know that there's a comfort level with Closter, confidence level, that's what they have with that firm. And if it's comparable, where we're compared apples to apples, I can tell you that Closter, I'm very comfortable, especially if Bonnie's gonna be involved. Yes, yeah, I feel exactly the same.
That gives y'all some guidance when you go to general, if we're gonna talk to them and say something, at least you can hear something from another board member. I know you've gone down to the classes with me.
I don't know.
Bonnie.
Well, if you saw her, then I saw her, because you've been to that same.
The tall one.
And usually the lead guy, he always teaches a major section as he can, and he handles some very big clients all across the country. He usually has a very pertinent role in kind of stuff that he's called on.
She was the one, the conference you went to, I believe, she was the one talking about the marital and all the cases with the, where husband and wife splits and all that stuff. She's usually very heavily involved in the family aspect, the beneficiary aspect, contingency beneficiary. She usually got a whole section on that.
Well, since we have the proposals, would you want to go through the remainder of the agenda and take a quick look at the two proposals that were presented? We've got copies of all of them in the office. We can do that today while we're here.
Let's leave it at the end. Okay.
That's fine. We'll just table that.
Let's move on to your discussion. I mean, I hate for Maria to sit here through, and welcome to the meeting, by the way.
Thank you.
And Doug to have to sit through any more of this.
I'm staying on.
Yeah, he's working.
I'm working.
On your wherever you need.
All right, so we'll table for now and come back to it. So we'll go to public input comment. There's no public, so I guess they have no input. Evaluation report.
I'm up.
Get on this.
Okay, you didn't expect you along. Don't have the iPad this time because I haven't been able to back in the office and pick them up. I did bring copies. I didn't anticipate quite so many. I passed out, I think everybody who's had 7 copies, and I'm just reading a PDF off my computer.
Do you need to look at one of these?
I wouldn't mind it, because I think it's gonna read into the.
Yeah, I've got it.
I think it's more important than you guys.
Okay, I've got one.
Okay. I think you guys know I usually like to start on page 5. And in case you're wondering, the columns are in the correct order. It's an interesting results. When you see big changes in the city's requirement as a percent of payroll, one way or the other, you might think you have the answer as whether you got a gain or a loss, you know, whether things were really good or bad. And in the actuary world, things aren't always quite as they seem. The news is all good, but the explanation, it takes an actuary to kind of lay it out for you. So the good piece of news is, as a percent of payroll, the requirements have dropped a lot. The city's estimate for the current year is the right-hand column on page 5. 37.3%. That number is going to fluctuate every year depending on payroll and depending on state money, so we always have to keep that from one year to the next. And as a reminder, the membership in the city came to an agreement, sort of an agreement, an MOU last summer regarding the use of state monies. Doesn't sound like it quite got to the mutual consent requirement under the new statute, but they at least agreed that the way things were being calculated under old state law, just let that be for now. And so the net result of that is the city basically gets dollar to dollar. Whatever Chapter 185 money comes in August every year, the city's using it. Because the
the calculation under the law that was in place in 1999, 2015, the city could use over $800,000 a year. And the monies are getting nowhere near that. So if the MOU is set, look, status quo, then whatever money comes in, we're just gonna plug in. And this last year is $584,000. So that's the update on the state money and the city's current year funding. And by the way, the city continues to put in more than the minimum required. I've looked over the last couple of years, and it seems like they're putting their part in as if the state money wasn't even coming in. They're allowed to use the state money to offset.
That is what Cindy was doing. She was using that figure.
It doesn't matter one way or the other, because all we're doing is we're building up that reserve account that it's basically money the city can use for funding the pension plan. We're giving it interest credits. And if they're paying the state contribution to come in, then the state money really goes to that account, gets interest.
If the city is going to use some of that money to pay down their portion of their, when do you need to do that evaluation?
Well, you don't have to tell us anything. Well, we'll look at the bank statements and see what they actually contributed. And if it was short, we borrow against that account. By the way, that account's up to $2,079,000, which is about 60, it's about two-thirds of the city's requirement for a year.
They're looking at possibly using the money in 7 years, or just coming out for the vote.
Yeah, so there's plenty there for them to do that. So you don't need to tell us anything. We'll take care of that. Budget for next fiscal year, 1920, we jump over one column to the left, and the city's requirement dropped a lot. So the estimate right now is 28.66% of payroll. So look at that and say, well, that's over 8% of payroll. We must have done really well. Well, you did beat your assumptions in total, but not by a lot. The two primary reasons, first, payroll went up a lot. It looked like there was a hiring frenzy.
There still is.
Still is that. Well, when there's a hiring frenzy like that, the city's contributions that are going in as a percent, there's the unfunded liability payment is a fixed dollar. And so fixed dollar looks smaller compared to a big payroll. It's sort of like you've got a debt payment. Let's say you've got a mortgage payment, you get a big raise. And so that debt payment looks smaller now because you've got more income coming in, and it's as smaller as a percentage of your payroll. Same thing here, then. The unfunded liability amortization payment, we calculate as a fixed dollar and convert to percent. If payroll goes up, the percent goes down. So in absence of having any unfunded liability at all, you wouldn't see such a big change from 1 year to the next. It goes in the opposite direction. If there's a layoff and we find smaller membership, smaller payroll the next year, city percent's gonna go up. But if payroll's still going up and new hires are coming in, percent could continue to drop. So that's the first part of it, is a lot of new hires. The second piece is there was a payment for the unfunded liability going back 10 years ago, a lost piece that expired. That one piece is paid off. So those two things combined were the primary reason the funding requirement dropped by over 8% of payroll. As a dollar amount, I don't know if the city's requirement, it could actually stay stable. If hiring keeps going on and you still get an ever-increasing payroll, a smaller percent attached to a bigger payroll, the city may end up having kind of a level dollar requirement. Which is good, you know, for budgeting purposes. A level dollar from 1 year to the next is good, and a report like this makes it look good. Before I move on to a couple of other pages, do you have any questions on this one, page 5? Funding requirements and the account, we'll call it the set aside or funding standard account for future payments. Okay. Let's talk about your funded status. If you jump over to page 10, the bottom,
It did have a nice increase this year. A lot of it had to do with that piece being expiring. And it's 77.7% last year, it's now back to 80.4%. If you meet your assumptions going forward, it should continue to go up, probably about 2 percentage points a year. So that's a piece of good news. Let's talk about your net gain and loss on the unfunded liability. If you jump over to page 17, let me break it down for you. The unfunded liability going into this report from a year ago was $19.9 million. That's a very top number. Think of that as like your outstanding payment for the unfunded. And that's like the whole, hey, you don't have to pay that all at once. That's, you pay that off with ongoing annual payments. But if you wanted to pay off the house all at once, $19.9 million. We do fund the plan so it's expected to go down. Yeah, that's what we want. So we expected it to be the number right below that 18.2. So like you get your outstanding mortgage every January, you know, for your taxes, and you find out every year the payoff's a little bit lower, right? So we expected it to be down to 18.2. But actuarially, it's not that simple. We add and subtract to it based on your experience compared to our assumptions. So we measure each of the main components. So the first one is the investment return. We were measuring against a 7.85, and it came a little bit lower than that. So on a five-year average, on a market basis, you did fine, you beat it. On a five-year average, a little bit short. So we had to add $276,000 to the unfunded. Salary increases, that's not payroll. I know you're hiring more and more people. But the officers who are here from 1 year to the next, they got a salary increase average bigger than the average that we're assuming. And you can do that from year. You can do that from time to time. It's no big deal. We're dealing with averages. So the salary increases came in at $209,000 kit to the unfunded, which, by the way, is those numbers compared to the size of the plan are small. The plans are, it's a big plan. Active decrements, think of turnover and retirement, you had gains there, that's why it's in parentheses. So really the turnover and retirements more than wiped out the salary increases. So I guess that's probably good. So you kick people out the door you don't want, you get everybody else to get salary increase and you break it. That's how that worked. And on the inactive mortality, retiree deaths, there was more than expected. That's why it's in parentheses. We're seeing more of that now because going back a few years ago, the state mandated assume people live longer. You know, the FRS mortality assumption were linked to it by state law. And by assuming that people live longer and longer, it's easier to get gains on the retiree side when they die. Because we assume they're going to live a longer time, and guess what? They're really not. So year over year, it could go either way. I think long term, it's probably a slightly conservative assumption, which means you should be getting some gains in the future. So net result is you had a total credit to the unfunded of $172,000. So when the dust settled, the unfunded started at 19.9, it's now down to 18 million. Going forward, I don't see any other pieces of the unfunded that will be dropping off for another 3 years. So I expect stability on the funded ratio side, meaning it should go up maybe a couple percentage points every year, meeting your assumptions. And if hiring still continues, then the city's percent I show on page 5 should continue to go down a little bit. It's like you get about everywhere, so it doesn't surprise me you're hiring officers to handle that stuff. That's the report. If you have a question, I'd be happy to answer.
I know I went to, I think it was the November meeting, and there was a lot of discussion about the assumption rate, and I think the state was talking about the recommended lowering of 7.4 7.45, even or somewhere 7.5 in that area. And I know we're at 7.85, and I know we've had some discussion about whether we should be going down to that level, and I kind of wanted to take on that.
Yes, that's the hot topic of discussion that has been. And I would encourage continued discussion on that. The average, let's go back in time, the number that used to be everywhere was 8%. You had it here for many years, so there's those plans. Well, the trend has been downward, and it's, to me, it's pretty much linked to what the big retirement systems in states are assuming. Florida retirement system is now, they keep lowering it a little incremental piece of it. Larry, are they down to 7.4 now? Something somewhere close to that?
I think that's
I think they're under 7.45. Yeah, and they were in the high sevens for a long time. CalPERS, the California system, I think they're right around the same 7.3 or 7.4. We just won Arizona State Police and Fire. There's hundreds of plans in that state. I think they're 7.3. So the trend is really these plans, these smaller plans, usually match those.
When do you see us getting that phone call like we got a few years back? Because I know you were involved in that when it was, no, you're going to do this because I said so.
Right. I'm still seeing inconsistency with how they're handling plans. So there's no real rhyme or reason. You are approved through either this report or the year before, so the cycle of review shouldn't come up for at least two more years. 80% is a nice funded ratio that usually takes them off the month. But 7.85 at the same time is now about the average. The average in the state is around 7.4, so.
Are we not at 7.75 for this year?
7.75. We went down another 10 beats, right?
Well, we're still at 7.85.
We're closer to this report,
but I mean, the current year we're in right now. October 1.
It's 7.75. Because we did stage.
Well, I've got a holding on this at 7.85, so I haven't lowered it yet, so. If it's 7.75, we could just do that with 10.119.
That was supposed to start 10.1 of 18, 7.75.
Okay.
Well, we went down from 8 in two steps because it was too many.
I see. Well, I still need to do that then. That's not built into this report. So the next report, we'll hold that board direction. So I will lower it to 7.75 with the next evaluation. But you could. If you want, you can modify it at this point and say, well, we can kick it down a little bit lower than that, or Doug, for now, do 7.75. We'll think about it, get back to you before you do the next report, maybe we'll do it lower. Or you can implement a glide path, like a 5-year plan to get down to X after we do the 7.75. Well, you have leeway.
Yeah, you remember when the state gave us the ultimatum, we begged them, don't make us do it all at once, and we did that, I think it was over 3 years. Then we've just done it again over 2 years. So I guess the consideration is whether we're going to do another 2 or 3 years to get closer to that number before as a preemptive strike.
Well, the answer is, one of your questions, you don't have to make the decision today. And since the state recently reviewed your plan and was approved, either with the 18 or the 17 report, they shouldn't be reviewing for a couple more years. So you've got some time. The only reason they would call is it wouldn't be random, it would be if your plan's on their radar for reviewing, but they don't review any more frequently than 3 years. So that shouldn't be coming up for a while. But my guess is you have time.
Do we have time until your next evaluation report next year?
Yeah, I won't be likely working on this until January. So you've got August and November to make any tweaks and fine-tuning. And like I said, you can say, Doug, we know you're set for 7.75 or 10.19. Make it 7.7, something, you know. And thereafter, say, we'll make another policy next year to decide if we want to go lower. You have some time now, and you've got some room.
Yeah,
how great of an impact is that on the city's funding? If it's done as in one fell swoop or incrementally?
Yeah, looking at, rule of thumb for your plan is if you wanted to go down 5 basis points, it would be probably a 0.5% of payroll. So, for instance.
5 basis points?
Yeah, about a half.
Would be a 0.5%?
About a 0.5%. So 10 basis points would be, I'm sorry. 5 basis points. Yeah. Yeah, because 100. Yeah, if it was only 5 basis points, 0.5% of payroll, 50 basis points would be 5% of payroll.
So we went from 7.75 to 7.79.
Half a percent. It would be it.
But if we got it down in like 1/10 increments for over several years, we'd be looking at maybe we did 2 years, 2% or 3% to a year.
So 10 base points would be 1% of payroll.
1% of payroll.
So if you did it 1/10 for 5 years,
if you did 10,
if you wanted to drop, if you anticipate payroll still growing, you could sort of offset the city as a percentage of payroll by going down even conservatively 10 basis points for a couple of years running, and the city's requirement should stay pretty stable.
The higher it makes up.
You could go 7, instead of 7.75, if you know payroll's been going up again this year, then you could modify the 7.75 and say, well, you know, maybe 7.7, and you could probably still absorb it.
Well, we won't know until the contract is. Police officers, servants, and lieutenants are in contract negotiations, so we don't know what raises will be until that's over for this October, next October, and the following October, if any.
Yeah.
But we do know between now and next October, with the 10 new positions and what we're short, we're talking about 20 officers.
Wow, so 20 on top of the pay raises to the ongoing group.
If there's pay raises.
Well, even when you say if, let's say you...
We had our last pay raise on October 1 of 2018 for this contract.
You mean, so you're going to get something like a COLA, at least, right?
Not necessarily.
Okay. But even if you don't, hiring 20 new officers will make payroll go up, which would allow you to absorb a reduction in investment return assumption without having a big impact on the city's percent of payroll funding. So this, the bottom line is, if you anticipate payroll growing the next couple of years, either through new hires and or raises to the ongoing group, that's a good time to try and glide that down so the city's percent of payroll stays fairly stable. And the funded status should still keep going up.
That was some good information. Let's get back to the evaluation report so we can move on, and then we'll come back to that. So,
I did not have to go. I stayed in the full meeting, but I'm done with the actual formal presentation. So you have a comfort level you can approve, and then we can continue having your discussion if you want.
I don't have any questions. Is there a motion to accept the October 1, 2018 evaluation?
I'll make a motion that we accept the October 1, 2018 evaluation.
Second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Now we need the Scott pension motion.
For purposes of this report, it is 785. And we don't have to deal with 775 or whatever it's going to be until a year from
now. We've already notified the state for the action taken last year to do an incremental. 7.75, and then to 7.75 as of one of last year.
You're allowed to modify that. So they don't write that stone, and you can say, look,
for a number of reasons, we're considering even lowering it below the 775, so, you know, it's going to be 10-119 until that next adjustment. But their books aren't open on you, you're reviewing that.
Well, but for purposes of this letter that has to go to the state, saying that for the near term, long term, intermediate term, this is the rate. You know, I've never given them a rate, any other rate other than the assumption rate.
Correct.
So is the right answer under that 37.85?
7.85.
Otherwise, it may cause a question.
That would be the only flag, is if you declare something other than this report, you'll say, well, which one is it?
So the answer to the question is I would recommend 7.85 as the expected return for the near term, long. I forget how that's worded. And I forget how that's worded, it's been heard so many times, but for the intermediate, you know, that letter, they don't come up.
The declaration of returns letter.
Yeah.
What were the purpose of the declaration of return letter? The current assumption rate is 7.85, the expected near term is 7.85, and long term is 7.85. And that's where the motion is.
Okay.
Am I saying that right?
Close enough, thank you.
Yes.
And we got the garbage in the previous letter.
All the letter for the last 400 years.
Do I have such a motion?
Do I have to repeat it?
I think you should say so moved. That effect.
So moved.
So moved. All I gotta do is say so moved.
So moved.
I would like to make a motion to the effect of what you just said.
And do I have a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
You can do that, Jeff, if you want me to.
All right, your lip balmed up, you ready? It's all you now.
Well, set, thank you.
It's all you.
All right, here you go. Well, thank you for having me here today. I have to say, I was very disappointed to see that it looks just like it's looked in New England for the last 3 months. I don't know if you've got any sun in the last 3 months, but we haven't, so.
Yes.
We actually have.
I would imagine. So, well, that's okay. Hopefully the sun will come out soon. So anyway, I'm Maria Basada, and I've been with the firm for over 20 years in various roles. I was for 10 years one of the portfolio managers on the Trumbull Property Fund. My last 10 years, though, I've been working on the client side as a liaison between the clients and the portfolio team. So I have three sections. One is your investment results since you've been with us. Then I'm going to talk about the firm, and then I'm going to talk about the fund you're invested in. Okay, great. So behind tab one, on page 5, your initial investment with us in 2014 in your reinvesting your dividends, your total deposits 1.2, and your current market value 1.7, giving you a gross IRR since inception of 8.48. And that is approximately what we expect for a total return on a core real estate fund between 8% and 9%, and the majority of that return is income. So this fund is a true core fund, not a lot of risk associated with the strategy, and so the reliance is mainly on the rents and the income. Behind tab two, our organization. We are a global real estate organization. We're one of the largest in the world. The common theme is that we're regionally organized. You want to be on the ground managing the real estate in the countries where you own the real estate. The fund you're invested in is managed out of our U.S. real estate department, and that is in Hartford, Connecticut. We have two regional offices in Dallas and California, San Francisco. We've been managing real estate for our clients since 1978. Our assets under management have grown to about $32 billion for over 760 institutional clients. Our clients are very representative of this group here. About 50% are state and local government plans.
We also have a smaller allocation now to corporate DB plans as they're getting out of the DB plan offerings to their employees. We also have Taft Hartley's in here, foundations and endowments. Our organization now is up to 219 employees. We've been growing our organization over the years as we've been growing our assets under management. I talked a little bit about risk. It is our mission to manage risk. We're good at identifying risk, assessing if it's appropriate for a particular strategy, then pricing that risk in the underwriting for that particular strategy. On the next page, page 8, right, this is a snapshot in the U.S. of our assets under management. Up top, over allocated to the east and the west. That is where the majority of the real estate is located in the U.S. right now. That is where the majority of the jobs as well. By property type, to the left, and this is again our entire organization, we're investing in, we're one of the largest apartment investors in the U.S. We also invest in industrial, office, and retail. And then we have a separate and distinct farmland capability. And then we also have a small allocation of hotel. There are a few hotels in the fund you're invested in as well. By strategy, to the right, the Trumbull Property Fund, which I'll refer to as TPF, is the fund you're invested in. It is our flagship fund. It represents a majority of our assets under management, close to 70%. We are on page 9. The heart of our business is to acquire, operate, lease, and sell real estate. If you look over to the right, you'll see how we're organized within our employees, our senior employees. Actually, this is our entire staff. And if you look at the asset management team under investment operations, and then we have an accounting team that represents almost half of our staff, and those are the folks that oversee each of the assets that we manage for our clients. And on the last page, page 10, we have a very deep team, not a lot of turnover at the firm. We have over 33 years of industry experience on the investment committee. To the left, the investment committee is represented by most of the disciplines at our firm, and they have to vote, they have a majority vote on any acquisition for any portfolio. 33 years of industry experience, and to the right is our senior folks across the different funds and the different disciplines have over 31 years of industry experience. The one change that, I'm not sure we were here last year, but the one change we had to the portfolio management team on the left is we added Rod Chu to the Trumbull Property Income Fund. That's not the fund I'm gonna talk about today. And Gary Gowdy's gonna retire. And also Paul Canning on July 1st of 2018 took over as a senior portfolio manager to the Trumbull Property Fund, and Kevin Crean also retired. So those are the two changes. And before that, we probably didn't have any changes to portfolio management for at least the last 10 years. And unless you have any questions on organization, I'll talk about the fund itself. Page 13 up top, you'll see these are just representative properties that we own across the U.S. So we have a research team. It's a top-down, bottom-up approach. We track the largest and fastest-growing markets in the U.S. There's about 65 of them, and we sometimes go off into secondary markets, but very rarely. And these are just the types of assets that are in the fund. The dedicated, experienced team on the next page. I talked about Paul Canning over to the left. He's a senior portfolio manager now. He's been, prior to taking over portfolio management of this fund, he was the portfolio manager of our value add fund for quite some time. He's been with the firm for a long time as well. Pam Thompson, the chief operating officer below that, also with the firm for quite some time, a lot of industry experience. And then they are supported by three other portfolio managers in the middle, and then two analytics folks. And these people are all focused on this fund that you're invested in. They have no other responsibilities at the firm. Page 15 and 16. So TPF is one of the largest open-end core funds in the U.S. It is the, what we think is the truest core fund. I'll talk about the risk associated with it in pages going forward. But it has a low level of leverage, which adds risk, and it also has a low level of value add, which in this fund, we do have a low allocation of value add meaning build to core. So sometimes, and especially in a market like right now, we may execute an acquisition through a build, you know, through building an apartment or building an industrial asset. But it's low right now in the portfolio, about 4.5% in the value add bucket. It's very well diversified by property type and geographic region. It also has a significant cash flow for flexibility of the properties for capital needs. It also is further diversified by owning larger assets, as we've looked at some of the pictures in the prior page. We have a stable income return. 84% of the total return since inception is represented by income. And we also have a very focused sustainability initiative where it's economically justified. Highlights on the next page, close to $22 billion in gross assets, 196 investments, leverage 18.1%, lowest in of all the Odyssey, ranked number one for Sharpe ratio and standard deviation. I'll talk a little bit about that on the next page. We have a 40-year track record, gross inception since return 8.9, and the gross dividend 4.2. The majority of our clients do reinvest that dividend, but you do have the option of taking that dividend if you need cash flow at some point in time. On page 17, I talked about the size and how well diversified it is. We do believe that you can mitigate risk by proper diversification. We have a research-driven proprietary inventory model that looks at the U.S., across the U.S., 65 largest and fastest growing markets. And based on the diversification of the United States real estate, that's what we base the fund on. That's how we try to diversify the fund. So if you look at the table below the donut, the target ranges on the left, that's research driven based on all their analytics they get from third party vendors. This indicates that the U.S. has more apartments and less office. And that is how we allocate the Trumbull Property Fund, with more apartments and less office versus our competitors, which is the last column, where they have more office and less apartments. So let me step back and talk about that. As I mentioned, we are one of the largest apartment managers in the U.S. We've always been bullish on apartments. Apartments react well to economic changes. You could raise the rents, you could lower the rents. There's always cash flow coming in. And the capital needs are very small. If you have a tenant move out, carpet you paint, move a new tenant in. So the age cohort recently, and as far as we can see, are still renters in that. And they're still growing and renting more. Our office exposure is 25%. We brought that down quite a bit from the last time we were here last year. We had brought the office allocation above our target ranges over the last several years because of some great opportunities we had in some major markets. But we did sell a few office investments last year. We brought that back down within our target allocation. Orange is retail, 22%. In retail. About half of that is in regional malls, dominant regional malls. The rest of that is in strip centers, grocery anchored centers across the U.S., 17% in industrial, and 3%, as I mentioned, a small allocation of hotels. We also diversify by geographic region to the right. We use the same target ranges. And then we have a third cut at diversification, and we look at, which I don't have here on the page, the economic sectors. So you may think if you own an apartment in Boston and an office in San Jose that you're very well diversified, but in reality you have two properties that are in markets that are very tech driven, so high exposure to tech. So we look at that, we make sure the fund doesn't have any over allocation in any economic sectors. Which brings us down to our risk analysis, and this is given to us on page 18 by two independent providers. The first one, MSCI, which looks at 9 different ways of measuring risk. And the Trumbull Property Fund is in orange. And the Odyssey benchmark is in blue. And as you can see, you really want to be with, you know, lower at all points on risk and inside of the Odyssey benchmark. The one spot that we're with Odyssey or equal to Odyssey is vacancy rate. But other than that, we're very close to the center, showing that we're very low risk. And then NCREIF calculates four risk measures on the right and reports those to us. We don't see any of this information of our competitors, so we have to rely on them. And as you can see, the standard deviation, Sharpe ratio, beta, and Jensen alpha, well, up until beta number one and Jensen alpha number two. So again, very low risk for compared to the other Odyssey funds in the U.S. Couple more pages on returns. So the primary objective of the fund is to provide a 5% real return over any given 3 to 5 year period. If you look to the 5 and 10, and since inception, we have exceeded that performance objective. The second performance objective is to outperform the Odyssey in all full market cycles. So we went back and looked at, and we tracked this, the last five cycles, including the current cycle, and the fund has outperformed with a lower risk metrics. So that's saying a lot for this fund. Any questions?
So do you consider do you consider 08 to 2019 a full cycle?
We're still in the cycle.
Yeah.
So far, We've been exceeding the current cycle. There's no telling. You could tell me what you think. There's no telling when the cycle's going to end. Yeah. But so. All right. On page 21, going on to our debt summary. We are, as I talked about, one of the lowest leverage, and this has a different number because this is dated as of December 31st. So the 7.5. is as of December 31st, but so we have a current leverage ratio of 17.5 versus Odyssey of 21.9, very, very competitive there. And we also have a very competitive interest rate. We have a fixed interest rate of 3.4 versus the benchmark at 4%. And we also have a greater fixed rate debt. 95% of the portfolio is fixed rate, so if interest rates go up, we'll be impacted by that on the interest rate side. And the benchmark is at 79% fixed rate.
You might take a second just to update on what the Odyssey benchmark is.
Okay. So the Odyssey benchmark was put together, I want to say, about maybe 15 or 20 years ago. And really, it's really just a compilation of funds with a definition that came up, that NCREIF has come up with, which is a leverage definition. It's a the four property types, you could invest in. And right now there's 24 other open-end funds in the Odyssey. And they range from $1 billion to $35 billion. So they're all across the spectrum. There's different ways that that some of our competitors utilize risk. Some of them invest in secondary markets. Some of them invest in operating companies, which means they would just, they'll buy a developer, the whole company, and develop their properties that way. So it is kind of just a compilation of different funds that have a sort of general definition.
It really is the benchmark, and that's what
that's all we have.
Compared to, yeah, it really is. Kind of like the S&P 500, if you will, of real estate, of this particular type of real estate market. So it's open-end funds, 24 of them, and it's just showing all the statistics relative to how they rank relative to all that in terms of leverage and that sort of thing. That's what she's comparing it to. So, you know, one of the concerns that the board has had in the past is that when I showed my report, you're trailing the benchmark. The benchmark being the Odyssey index.
Right.
And I don't want to speak for you, but one of the reasons being very low leverage in a fairly strong market environment, so they haven't gotten any benefit from the low leverage, I guess. They didn't get the benefit of high leverage that some of the others that borrow more money. So they have a real focus on risk-adjusted returns versus some of the other funds in that benchmark.
And we've always had, me being in the role of Matt, we've always sold the fund as having a very low leverage ratio. And during the last downturn, a lot of the funds had gone up to like 30% in leverage, and we kept ours at 10 or 15. And during the last downturn, we had the highest returns because of that and the lowest risk. We've just been in such a long upturn, and it's been just such a long period of time that we have underperformed over the short term, the 1, 3, and 5. So the next page, unless you have any other questions on page number, looks kind of weird. Isn't it 22 and 07 on it?
Yeah, 22.
Okay, so on the next page, this is just to let you know that we do have a green philosophy, that we reduce environmental impact where it maximizes total returns. We're ranked number 5 of 42 in the GRESB benchmark report, and this is another sort of real estate report that's that the managers all self-report into. And based on the 42 that they track, we're number 5. And this is really important to us. As you can imagine, a lot of our tenants, it's very important for a lot of our tenants as well. They're looking for LEED designated offices or apartments or industrial properties. And then a little bit on what we're doing on page 23. As I mentioned, in 2018, we materially reduced our office allocation. That's to the right. So our, you know, our goal is to invest thoughtfully and to sell strategically. And last year, we had the opportunity to sell several of our office investments. Sales price was 3% greater than the last appraisal, and the sale price was 33% greater than the cost basis. So we refreshed our asset quality by selling offices, some older multifamily, and reduced our allocation to hotels as well. We were also acquiring assets during 2018. It's a lot lower than we had been in the past. We find that pricing and competition is very high. The one way we can get access to real estate is through the value add component that I talked about before. And what we do there is that is we'll find, we actually have an industrial partner that we build industrial assets with. And we also partner with a lot of the multifamily developers in the U.S. And we closed out three multifamily and 18 industrial. Going forward, and we're already in May, unbelievably, we're going to keep the same emphasis on multifamily. We have a greater allocation than Odyssey. We'd like to keep that, sell the older multifamily, build some newer multifamily. Office, we probably won't be acquiring any office this year, so just managing the office type and the lease rollover at those properties. Retail, I could stop for a second and just talk about retail. So as you can imagine, retail, as you've probably been reading and hearing about, retail has been undergoing a huge change. The malls themselves, there's 5 malls in the portfolio right now. We're focused on 2 of the large malls. One of them below Cambridge Side Galleria, that's up just outside of Boston, is a very large mall, one of the largest assets in the fund. We are in the process of renovating that. The first step was to renovate the 3rd floor of the mall into office space, which we're in the process of doing, and we already have a lot of interest in that space. The market, that particular market outside of just in Cambridge, has like a 2% vacancy rate. It's the lowest in the U.S. So we're doing well with that. We also have a mall in Dallas that we're in the process of renovating. So as I said, 44% of the retail portfolios and enclosed malls, those are all in different various stages of renovation, or we may sell some of those as well. The retail component, if we looked at our returns over the last quarter, we did have write-downs for the most part, negative returns on the retail component, which we think a lot of the others in Odyssey are experiencing the same type of write-downs. And then industrial, that's the most favorite property type right now, you know, with the Amazons and all the internet sales and needing for storage and industrial space, that is one of the popular property types. We're continuing to build with our partners there. and in very, very different markets across the U.S. It has access on the next page, similar to last year, improve the quality of the portfolio. We think we're going to acquire about 500. I'm not sure we're going to hit the 750. And then we're still looking at selling about $2 billion in assets. And then just to summarize in the last couple of pages, so we think right now the fund is very well positioned for the current market. It's in the 10th year of recovery. Our NOI growth is moderating. Appreciation is definitely at a slower pace. The fund has a very low risk profile, very well leased, very low leverage. And we're also focused on, which we have always been focused on, improving the assets and driving NOI growth. I look kind of quick. Any questions?
Any questions, gang? I think she addressed some of the underperformance relative to the benchmark, and it's sort of the same story with some of the managers we've talked about that have trouble on the equity side keeping up in the bull market, and we haven't had much down market to see what they do in terms of protecting the assets on the downside. And I think this kind of falls into that same category. You have another real estate manager that might be a little bit more aggressive and can keep up a little better in the bull markets, but historically anyway, UBS has done a good job of protecting the downside while still doing what we've asked them to do. When you got into this asset class to begin with, it was to allow us really to kind of diversify a little bit more, but to diversify by lowering our fixed income allocation. We didn't think bonds were going to give you much in return, so we wanted to go into some other asset classes, convertibles and real estate were two that we went into. From that perspective, their five-year return, I'm looking at it right now, has been 8.6% per year for the last 5 years. So obviously that's a lot better than what you got in the bond market, which has been between 2 and 3%. So every dollar that went into there, even though they've underperformed that benchmark a little bit in a strong market, I think that probably it would be well to just stay patient. That's why you have a couple managers in the space, and stay a little patient and see if they do protect from the market when the market does go the other way. Not predicting that by any means. But I do think, you know, you've had an 8.6% return. I don't think that's a, that may be a little bit high for the expectations maybe for the next year or two, at least for the near future, because I think your income is probably going to stay between 4 and 5%. But I think the appreciation is probably going to drop down to 1 or 2%. So I would say 7 to 8% would be a realistic expectation in the near term. Still better than what we can get on bonds, so no reason to get out of the asset class. This is the time to ask any questions. If you have any questions about any of the properties or their allocation.
What usually guides the amount? I think we're investing about 5% in the real estate area. What's usually the guide in your mind as to that percentage and how you determine how much you want to invest in that?
Well, we have a lot of models, you know, that we just try to run risk return profiles for all the asset classes and put them in the models and see what we think. But like, you're a little bit low. I have actually thought a couple times about increasing that allocation, but because we have the convertible allocation and real estate and a little bit in the MLPs, I've opted not to do it. So it's just really what gives us the, you know, our ultimate goal, Steve, is to get to the 7.75, whatever that magic number is, with as little risk as possible and combining those asset classes to get us there. So almost all plans you'll see out there now, I shouldn't say almost all. I would say the average is probably closer to 9 or 10% in real estate, but a lot of those plans don't have convertibles. Larger plans typically don't have convertibles because the asset class isn't liquid enough for multi-billion dollar plans to take big positions in that asset class. So I've got you a little bit underweighted there relative to maybe the national average, but I've also got you underweighted to fixed income relative to the national average, so I think that both know what they're supposed to do. But there's a chance if we go anywhere with the asset class down the road, I'd say it'd probably be up. Maybe we might take it up a little bit down the road. Good question.
just for what it's worth, up until recently, you couldn't invest in that index. There is a fund out there now that you can invest actually in the Odyssey Index, but it also has about a 1.7 or 1.9% fee associated with it. It's relatively new, so we haven't, we're looking at it right now, but we haven't put too much in it yet. We've got a couple small plans that are really kind of an ideal investment for smaller plans who don't meet the minimum requirements of UBS or American Realty or some of the other managers that are in there. But it also comes at a higher price.
Have we been with this fund for a long while?
What was the date on that?
Coming up on 5 years.
Yeah.
Coming up on 5 years.
Yeah, see, at least 5 years worth of data.
Yeah. It's been a little bit over 5, I think. And I think Maria just pointed out, was that what, 8.6%? 8.48%?
Yeah.
That's exceptional. That's an annualized figure. They got roughly 8.5% return per year. With very little volatility, which is one of the reasons I like the asset class. And I recommended it to you. You can also get into real estate through something called REITs, which are real estate investment trusts, which are really just real estate that's securitized. They trade their stocks. They trade like stocks. They trade their stocks. And while they've had some periods of good return, you'll see a lot more volatility in REITs and a lot higher correlation to the stock market. So from a diversification standpoint, they don't really help smooth the ride as much as this type of product does. So we still like this product for the real estate exposure. So I think you have to recognize here that you do have a manager that does take a less aggressive approach, doesn't borrow a lot of money relative to their peer group, doesn't buy speculative properties really. Generates, I think the stats were 84% of their total return comes from the income stream. So they're not buying, you know, instead of going in and buying a low value property, but they're going to go up in value tremendously. They would expect, I think, to get, you know, basically an inflation return on the value of the property. But most of the income is coming, or most of the return is coming from income, which is much more predictable.
I know you said you guys own a few malls and everything, but you're renovating, say, four into the office space. Is that because of the online markets?
It's mainly because of the online markets. I mean, the malls are getting, you know, a lot, as you've been hearing, I'm sure, a lot of stores are closing. Macy's is closing stores.
Oh, we've got one right out here that's dying on the vine.
I know, it's a shame. Some of them are getting completely knocked down and being converted to industrial space. Some of them are... So the Cambridge side, that's the first phase, but we also have a Macy's pad that we're going to develop into apartments, and it's in a really great market. That was a great location for the Cambridge side mall. In Dallas, that's going to take a little bit, you know, it's not in the same type of market, so we're looking at renovating some of the space and adding restaurants and, you know, Lucky Strike, and, you know, to make them into areas that people just want to shop a little bit, but also want to hang around, have dinner, and do other things while they're there. It's happening across the U.S. It's definitely a transition, but there's still people who want to shop, and retail sales actually have been going up. So it's not like people aren't spending money; they're spending it, but they're doing it online. So yeah, the stores are all trying to figure out how to have online stores and, you know, how to have stores and then have sales online and have people come in and return at the stores so they'll actually shop at the store. So they're going through a transition as well.
So there's still some malls that are working.
Yeah.
I was in Millennium Mall in Orlando this weekend. I haven't been there probably for 2 years. This is just
a cheesecake.
Well, that's true. That was good.
There's some in Miami that do great too. Yeah, there are some that do great.
So your company, your fund, tends to see the future as more of the apartment office space.
Yeah, I mean, we've always been bullish on apartments. We always thought apartments were the best place to be, the less riskiest property type, because over the long term, that's why we've outperformed on the risk, on the risk.
What do you consider that, like, because one of the big pushes here, and I can only speak from my experience here in Ohio, is to get the jobs, to build the apartments, to build the houses and everything, big push, push, push on the industrial. With the, especially, and when we talk about the online stuff.
Right.
We have three online centers, well, two major online distribution centers, and then FedEx to ship all their stuff.
Right.
Right next to each other, and that's been the push, is to get that stuff here. Do you see that as where the apartments are gonna go, is wherever these companies decide to build?
I'm not sure that's where they're going. I think the apartments will come first. They'll be near where the jobs are, where the people want to be. And then the Amazons are going to want to build their space or have space near the people in the apartments to get their products to them in, within one day, because they're making one-day promises. So they have to have, they have to be able to ship within one day. Yeah. I mean, the industrial space is mainly going near the airports and the major highways. But industrials, we're increasing our industrial as well. We think that's a good property type. Diversification is really the key, though, to have the right diversification across the 5 and the 4. All right, well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
No problem. You know how to reach me if you have another question. Oh, that's okay. I mean, if you have sunshine. Maybe tomorrow.
Yeah, we're
still
here
tomorrow for a little bit, so. All
right. It will be sunny tomorrow.
Oh, good. All right, thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Oh, all right. That works.
For only 15 minutes.
For only 15 minutes.
Yes, that's all you
can get. Bye, thank you. All right. You're up, Mr. Cole.
All righty. Well, this is getting kind of a long meeting, so I'll try to be a little quicker than usual. The quarter we're referring to here in the book is the March quarter. It was a very strong quarter. Everything I said about the December quarter at the last meeting, just flip it over, and that's what happened this quarter. If you go to page 2, you can see on the very top of the page, it's all the different, a lot of different indices, both stocks and bonds. And the interest rate, everything was up, as you can see across the board. So it was a very good quarter. We were having a very good quarter until today, for the second quarter of this year. And it's given about all the gains of this current quarter back today. And then some probably. I haven't checked it out for about an hour, but it was down 600.
564
is about 2%. So roughly 2% of the market. And we were up about 2% quarter to date. So even on a year-to-date basis, we're probably back to about the numbers you're looking at here today. So it's probably a pretty close estimate of where we are, as we said here today. If you go to kind of flip through the pages, why don't we just skip to page 9 real quick. This is the asset allocation as of 3/31. That has changed just ever so slightly, and I forgot to pull that up. We had to make a lot of payouts here in the last month or so, and so we pulled some money from stocks, and anyway, it's changed just a little bit, but not a whole lot. So we still like domestic equities. This China thing that's causing the markets to go crazy today, in my opinion, is completely overblown. It'll be a short-term hiccup in the market. Everybody's making it out to be a much bigger deal than I think it is. And I think ultimately we will win, not to get into politics, I just think we will win that trade war. Our economy is in much better shape than China's right now. We can weather a storm a lot more than them. And what we're talking about, I think if I heard right, is that less than 2% of our goods are being hit with this tariff. So it's not a huge impact on that. Where I think it is hurting the most are the farmers, U.S. farmers who do export a lot there. And I think that both sides of the aisle there will probably come together and do some kind of a plan if this thing gets prolonged and help the farmers out. So, at least I hope they do, because I do think they are taking a pretty big hit. So you can see the allocation, and Steve, you asked about real estate. If anything, down the road, we might increase that a little bit more as markets maybe settle down or scare us a little bit more. I'm not, I think, you know, you hear a lot about valuations in the domestic stock market, U.S. stock market. They're a little bit higher than the 75-year average in terms of the price-to-earnings ratio. So I will concede that valuations are a little high based on long-term averages, but they're not high when you take into account that we're still in a historically low interest rate environment. When interest rates are low, the stock market will support a higher valuation. And so we're talking about a 75-year average PE of maybe 15 and a half times earnings. And now we're selling at about 17 times earnings, but that's 75 years. If you look at periods where interest rates are very low, I'd almost make an argument the stock market's selling at a discount right now, not a premium, where rates are. So, and with this China thing, the one thing that probably will come out of this is there's less likelihood that the Fed will raise rates this year and more likelihood that the Fed will actually lower rates again this year. So the longer it goes on, the more you can bet that the Fed will probably cut rates, which would actually probably give us a rally in the market, at least short term. So just kind of weather these storms. I think most of you have seen it before. You get overreaction. We got way too many news channels covering the market, and we got nothing else to talk about. So just sit tight. I mean, it is a little different with this administration, no doubt, and trying to... In their language anyway, trying to fix years of unfair trade practices there. So we'll see how, we'll see who flinches first, I guess. But right now is definitely a trade war going, and something we hopefully would avoid, but we didn't. If you go to, your managers are on page 10, but we'll look at them in a little more detail. Going over to page 12. The plan was up for the quarter, up 9.3%. I'm on page 12 on the very top line. 9.3%, that ranked in the top 44%. 50 would be average of public pension funds around the country, so a little bit better than the average public pension fund around the country. However, our fiscal year to date was still a little bit negative. We're probably flat to slightly negative as we sit here right now today. And that ranked a little bit below average in the 72nd percentile. But your one-year return, your three-year return, and your five-year return, as you can see in the ranking, or at least relative to other pension funds, the plan is doing well. We're not making it right now. Well, the three-year made the assumed rate, but the one and the five-year, 2018 kind of dropped us off for that five-year average, so a little bit below the 785 or 775. So that may be an argument. At least current trends could be an argument to start low and continue the lowering the rate a little bit at a time, especially if you have other things to offset it, which I'm hearing that you do in terms of a lot of new officers being hired. And so that tends to offset the cost of lowering the assumption rate. So what I've been telling clients is, do I think 775 is a reasonable expectation over the long term? Yes, I do. Is Doug correct that the trend certainly in the trend throughout the country has been to lower the rate? Yes, that has certainly been the trend. Has that trend been done because, you know, why has that happened when the market's been so strong? And the reason, I think, has been that for the last 5 years, every time we have a bull market, which we've had for 10 years now, the capital market forecasts are that the bull market's going to end and you're not going to get those returns any longer. And so that's kind of the consensus, is that equities aren't going to give us what they've given us the last 30 years. It's going to be lower. I don't really agree with that, but because the same, if you went back to the late 90s, there was a big push by the same people now that are lowering the rate. There was a huge push to raise the assumption rates in the late 90s because stocks had been 20% a year for 5 years, particularly on the corporate side. You saw a lot of assumption rates up above 9% on the corporate pension side. And, you know, that was the wrong time to be doing it. So I don't know that's a wrong time to be lowering rates, but if you do lower rates, lower them a little bit at a time. If you lower them too fast, too much, that impacts the cost of the city significantly. That then impacts your ability to go to the city and ask for more benefits or to hire more employees. And I don't think it's necessary. We can show you the long term. Yeah, I got you.
Clearly,
I got you. Anyway, that's the reason. So if you have something to offset, if you have something to offset it, and the timing may be good from what I'm hearing from Doug and from y'all, is it might be a good timing to continue on this 1/10 of a, that'd be my suggestion, 1/10 of a percent over the next 5 years, so I'm trying to get down to 7.25.
This has been going on, because you, I don't know, you don't think about it as being that long until you realize that that teleconference that we had was in 2011. Because we were in my office in the traffic unit.
We were at 8.5 then, right?
And we were at 8.5. And the push is still, and it's still, it's consistent, and they keep consistently telling us and consistently legislating out of Tallahassee that local plans will do and will be guided by the principles of what FRS does. And if FRS keeps going down, and our advisory board keeps going up, down, 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 it's only a matter of time before we have one of them on the phone again telling us.
Well, I think the likelihood of that happening is very slim as long as they see your trend, what you're doing right now. I mean, they've already seen that you lowered it, and if you have another plan to continue to lower it 10% to 2%, I think you would keep them happy. I don't know, I don't know of anybody right now at 7.75 or below that's gotten them any trouble from the state. But that's just me. Doug may know some, I've never seen some, but that seems to be kind of a magic number.
The last thing that you sent out was a summary of everybody. The meeting, though, was around 7.6.
Yeah, that's definitely the trend.
He's bouncing back to assumption rate or something.
Yeah, sorry. The returns, you can see on this page, still on page 14. No, I'm on page 12. Page 12, Westwood had a little bit of a difficult quarter, I guess you'd say, but they were up 10.7%. So they were below their benchmark. They're still in the top third, all the way across the board, top 20%, and ahead of the benchmark on return, so they're doing a fine job for you. Sawgrass, kind of the same story, although they've been a little bit more volatile. That large cap growth space has been really dominated by some large tech names. Sawgrass has owned them, but tends to not own them anywhere near the weighting of the index itself. They're a little more conservative, so they protected really well in your down market. You can see their one-year return was positive where that benchmark was actually negative. So they're actually doing what you kind of expect. I see them in a few other places, so very consistent there. I really don't, the MLPs, we'll talk, just look at that return pattern across there and you'll see why I'm not adding any to it just because of the volatility. But you were up 16.5% for the quarter and you're still down 1.8% fiscal year to date, but you're up 14.8% for the year and up 6.4 for three, but still negative for five. So just a wild ride. Just hang in there. I still think, if oil's at $60 to $70 a barrel, they're going to be pumping like crazy. Natural gas, we're already exporting, they're pumping like crazy. It's going through the pipelines. We have pipelines and storage, that's what you own. And they're improving their balance sheets considerably across the board. A lot of the MLPs are going to C-Corp, so you, a lot of what you, it's labeled as MLPs, it probably should be labeled as infrastructure because you're now on C-Corp companies. It's an accounting thing, but it's kind of important. It's forcing them to improve their balance sheets and to not borrow as much money. So they're not as susceptible to rising interest rates. They're not as highly levered as they have been in the past. And we should start to see that reflected in some of a little more consistent returns, I would hope. That's not a big allocation. I think we're 3.5% or so, I think, right now, 3.1. So we'll just hold for now as we have been. The convertibles, again, a kind of bond substitute, done a good job for that space. I'll remind you that Advent is conservative in that they're only going to buy convertible bonds that have some downside protection. So they don't get into the ones that are so far into the money or so far that they'll behave just like a stock on the downside. They protect you more on the downside, typically. International. It's kind of a wild space, obviously, with everything that's going on with the trade wars. I mean, you've got exposure to Euro-Pacific Fund, big exposure to Europe and Asia, as you might guess. So with that particular product, we're just a little bit underweight at the target. It's tempting to nibble in there and maybe increase it a little bit. The valuations are attractive, but the volatility has, and the unknowns are still too great there, so I'm not going to take it up any further. And then you heard from one of your real estate managers, so you see the real estate returns there, and then you see bonds. Bonds are just not a lot of places to make money. It's kind of a very weird universe. Sawgrass is doing fine for what they've been asked to do. They can't buy a lot of junk, and junk has done pretty well. High yield stuff, they can't own it. So they're beating the benchmark, and that's what you ask them to do. So we're underweight there, and we'll continue that underweight. I guess maybe for the purposes of our discussion too, page 19 are your fiscal year returns dating back to 2005. So there's 14 full years here, and 10 out of those 14 years you've beaten that assumed rate of returns. So would that be an argument to leave it where it is? Maybe so. This year we're back down though to the negative position. We're flat to negative as we sit here today, I would guess, based on the way the market's behaving today. So. And then the last page I'll cover is on page 20, and this is kind of a long-term. Are we meeting the long-term objectives of the plan? I think this says yes. If you go to the top left, what that says is that top left of that chart says for the last 10 years, well, last 5 years, you go back and look 5 years. So there's 10 years worth of data there. Every quarter we look back 5 years. So it's a rolling five-year number. 80% of the time the plan is ranked in the top 25% of this public pension fund, a national public pension fund. 20% of the time it's ranked in the second quartile. So 100% of the time over the last 10 years, your plan is ranked in the top half, 80% of the time in the top quartile. And then if you go down to the bottom right, I'd like to see that down market capture a little lower, but you see down market capture of 96%. So that means when your benchmark, your target index is negative, you're not capturing all of it, which is a good thing. You're capturing 96% of the downside, but you've been capturing 103% of the upside over the last 5 years. So over the longer term, I would expect those numbers to be more like 85 downside and maybe 98, 97 upside. So it's been a little bit different, but we have, at least it's still the right ratio. You're capturing less of the down markets than you are, and you're capturing more in the up markets than the benchmark itself. So I think the diversification has helped the plan. I think that's evidence of that. That doesn't mean you've got several managers now, so that doesn't mean we're always not looking at somebody and wondering if that particular manager's keeping up, which is, you know, what we do.
Did it under skew because of how volatile it is and the managers aren't catching it as quick as they normally
would? No, I don't think it's skewed at all. I think that's actually pretty consistent with what I see across all of our plans, but I think that's the best report card. That page is the best report card of all because it gets us through all this. It says, is that combination of managers doing what we hope it would do for the plan? That's smooth the ride and still beat the benchmark and beat most of the plans out there, and that's what it's done. So I think the reason some of your managers are having trouble keeping up is because in a strong bull market, and Sawgrass is a perfect example. Sawgrass might own an Apple, it might own an Amazon, but they're not going to own it anywhere near the benchmark. They might own 4-3% or 2.5%, where the benchmark might be 6. So if it goes up, even though they own it, they're not going to go up as much as the benchmark. So. But what happens is when that market rolls over, Sawgrass, again, is a perfect example. They're typically a manager who's going to give you about 80%, maybe 70 to 80% of downside capture of the market, but maybe only 85 or 90 of the upside. Over time, that's a pretty good, you compound that out, you kind of like it. They'll beat the benchmark. So we've been in 10 years of a bull market, and we're still, the combination of managers is working. So if there was ever a time when there was gonna be 10 years worth of data where you wouldn't rank high, I don't think it would have been this period, but it seemed to work out. And part of that was the asset allocation too. Because we trimmed back your fixed income several years ago, anticipating that we weren't gonna make a lot of money in bonds. And that really helped. And we went into convertibles and, well, convertibles and real estate have helped MLPs to be determined. Yeah, yeah. So of course, I'll be moving to it. I still think we're in the early innings of that game. If you think longer term,
I don't think I'm really in stretch, Larry. Really,
you want to call a relief pitcher then?
I'm thinking about it.
Just did 16.8%.
Yes, morning, I'm losing 35.
Based on history, that's very possible.
Exactly. Gas is going down.
8.3, you're number 6.4, Tim. Depends on when you look at the numbers.
It's summertime and they'll go down.
See what happens. They were having a good quarter up until today. I think oil down today too, so that's probably a little bit.
Okay, so it's like every conversation in this meeting you brought us back to assumed rate of return. We're back to assumed rate of return. My opinion is, I understand what he's saying, I understand what he's saying, I don't trust EMS, as far as I'm thinking of the Berlin, and I, something's just tingling and making a little critical back when they stand up and go, they're fixing to hit us again, or start hitting plans again, maybe not us this time, but whoever's up for review. And I've kind of the opinion to keep the downward track a little longer.
Are you in agreement to gradually do it?
Yeah, no, I'm fine with that. I'm fine. Because we looked at it way back when I first got on the board and you did the proposal for us that, you know, it was something to go down a whole, I want to say 2% maybe even. But all, because we were way up at 8.5 then. And so maybe it was 1 to go to 7.5. And it was like $2.5 million to the city to do it in that one fell swoop back then. And that was right at the downturn time. So I know I'm all for no more than a tenth of the time, but I'm thinking if we're at 7.75, you know, we went from 8 to 7.75 in 2 years. We could do the same thing again, or we could go down a tenth, 3 years.
You're looking at 7.50.
It just feels to me like we're closer, because when we were the outliers, and say, oh, Larry, correct me if I'm wrong, when we were the outliers and we were the last of the Mohicans at 8.5%, they came down hard and they said, you will be 8 in 2 years. Which was a much bigger hit, and at the timing of when they hit that, the city had literally just passed the budget. And we had to run and tell 2 or 3 fiscal people to vote.
Yeah.
You know, we needed another several hundred thousand dollars right now, and luckily it was there. But I don't want to do that again. But I'm open to any option, any number. I just think maybe it's the right time to keep inching it down a little bit at a time, just to keep it close to FRS, because FRS has consistently, since I've got been on this board, consistently lower, and everybody's followed them, and everything that they're saying is done is all about.
What is that for us, Trevor?
I don't know.
I think it's around 7.4. That's what
seven four or 7.45. I don't remember which number it was, but it's one or two.
My thought coming in here was to gradually do it as well for around 7.5. Because it would get as close to where FRS is over time. Provide that for us stabilizes.
I will say in the past when they did, you were the highest plan of 8.5.
Yeah, well, like 8 or 10 of us in the state.
I didn't have any other plans at all that were 8.5, so they were zeroed in on you, no doubt, at that 8.5 rate.
Yeah, you, I know what numbers you're speaking of, but if we got those numbers from Doug, they kind of had plans across the.
Yeah, they all made it, they were playing across the state, and what's sticking in my mind is getting at least around that median number.
Because I thought it was around 7.6.
Seven six five, something like that, is what's sticking in my mind. At least hanging around that number.
Right.
If not a little bit below it, just for it keeps you off the radar thing. Let's do a big.
I think the transplant didn't continue. So the 785 at some point will become among the outliers. So during the times when payroll is increasing, if the board is inclined to begin talking about the glide path, then, and you're always talking about it, and it just, you want to figure out when's the best time to do it. It seems to me the next couple of years is the time to start moving it down for all the reasons discussed today.
What happened to our discussion from a year ago where we were doing 7.5 and 7.6? We've already taken our first step.
What we did in 2 years was 7.85 and 7.75. Now we're talking about the mayor getting down to at least a meeting.
We just had action earlier in this meeting at 7.85.
But that's because that's what he used.
Declaration of returns will always use the rear view mirror. But we're discussing what the policy to put in place for a continued glide path spectrum for future evaluations.
Because the next valuation will be 7.75,
correct?
Even if we've gone to 7.65 at that point, by the time you do it.
Well, we've got time. It won't be 8 months until I work on the next report. So without any further direction, it's going to be 7.75.
Yeah, because that'll be what it is on at the end of this fiscal year. If at the start of the next fiscal year we said we're going to go to 7.65 today, you'd still do it at 7.75 because that's what it was on 9:30.
Yeah.
So I think the question really is, do you want to continue this glide path of 0.1% for the next couple of years, or whatever, to get down to the 7.5 range or 7.4 range or something like that?
Even if it was 2 years to get us to 7.6, I'm fine with that. Just get me around that median number, because that's where my danger point starts picking up. But I'm fine with 7.5.
I would have for that as long as it's like gradual on that one.
So you want to go from 7.75 to 7.5.
Over a couple of 2-3 years.
Yes.
Just like we went from 8 to 7.75. And I'm fine with 3 if we went, 10th, 50, basically. I don't care. Or just 10th, and we'll be at 7.55. I just think that's where the train is headed, and I don't want to see us get caught out there again like we did in 2001.
And your fear of getting caught out there again is if they demand it, they could demand to drop it a larger amount and have a bigger impact.
He gave in to us, if you'll recall, and it's because we were like, they just passed the budget, dude. You're asking me for 11.59.59 to
to go in there for, and it was well over $500,000 at that time, after they had passed it. So he said, okay, fine, we do it over 2 years. So we went to 8.3, and then we had to go from 8.3 to 8.0 the next year, and those affected that greatly. And those affected the city pretty good. I just don't want to see that happen again. I mean, granted, it wasn't our doing, but in a way it was our doing, because we had had the very first meeting I sat in here as a board member, we had a discussion about lowering assumption rate and didn't do anything, and then 2 years later got caught on pants down.
Gave me, what is the potential downside?
It costs the city a little bit of what you said, we say. It costs them a little bit more money.
But it appears that based on the increase in payroll, that's going to be more than
that. That is what I'm hearing. Yes. Long term, that's what affects his assumptions and how he does it.
So what are we potentially, hours of force, or worst case scenario, what are we potentially exposing ourselves to? We go to lower the assumption rate and do what our cloud is out there. There's someone jump at us and say,
well,
that because
I don't know.
They're not even said you shouldn't have done that unless the city was involved.
So they, I mean, so that's my question, is you not seeing a downside to it?
I will tell you that cities are more and more inclined, and have been, actually some have perhaps said coming to pension board meetings and asking what policies being put in place to lower, and I've been kind of surprised this last year, like cities, why are they showing up asking? And it's the bond rating agencies and their independent auditors are starting to inquire, so they're sending reps to the pension board, so there's kind of an alignment now to get this assumption down. You may not get as much pushback from the city as you think. It might be something they've already been asked.
Ultimately, the performance ends up where the assumption rate, the performance, where the performance is, and the assumption rate is what affects what he's going to come up with 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road from now.
And I think especially if it's done incrementally, it's done as one big huge change.
Yeah, no, I don't want to. I definitely don't want to do that.
Where are we ultimately want to be in 3 or 4 years? 7.5, 7.4.
Six
would be a line of IRS.
Seven, I'm comfortable with 7.5. 7.5 is below the median. It's very close to where FRS is. So if they keep moving, the glide path can always continue if this trend continues 15, 20 years from now, long after I'm gone, long after you're gone. You know, somebody will be here and go, okay, they started this way back when and have just kind of followed along. There it is. And it doesn't become shocking. Because it was shocking in 2011, and it was scary. And it was not as far as to be the one to go and break that kind of news to a bunch of people.
Part of that was due to the time.
So,
mm-hmm.
So I'm with Lenny, educate me. So if we're looking at getting to a 7.5 ultimately, I want to do it over a time period. If we do, what did you say, 10 points?
Yeah.
Do we have to do 10 points every year, or can we modify that? I mean, if we do 10 points this year, maybe next year we do 5. Is that...
We could do it as... We could do this a year at a time if we wanted to. We could go... If somebody was to make a motion right now, say, we're going to lower it, you know, to 7.65 effective 10-1 of 2019, and somebody seconded it, boom, that's it. Or we could say, we're going to lower it, you know, that 10th of... a percent in 2019, another 10th on.
Okay, but what I'm saying is whatever, so it's incrementally, you don't have to, whatever you set now for your goal is 2019.
It's not etched in stone, and it may be revisited next year or the year after.
Yes.
Alicia's drafted out something here, 0.05% per year over 6 years, you can go from 7.75 down to 7.5.
over 6 years?
7.7, 7.65, 7.60, and it'd take us 6 years to 2024 to get down to 7.5, basically.
We know that our hiring is going to be getting faster and faster, so it's a short one. I can tell you from a training perspective, we've got 10 employees in the pipeline right now, and that's not counting the 10 employees. So based on that and what he's advising us, I would be more inclined to take a larger chunk right now, while it is invisible generally, than to try and hire it down over a long period of time when that hiring trend will change. Because, I'm not saying the whole chunk right now, but maybe to go, you know,
take a big, Our outflow is going to slow down dramatically. Because there's only a handful of us that are at that 25 years right now, and everybody else is 10 years out. It's 10 years before this next group of people that's getting promoted to sergeants and lieutenants and stuff are going anywhere. So you've got like three majors, five or six captains, and six lieutenants that are the only people likely to leave in a next 10 years unless they quit for greener pastures or get fired.
I guess my thought process is that I would prefer to make a one-year decision on the count and then revisit as it goes. Knowing that we have a target number that we want to get to, but rather than making a motion that would lock us into 3 years of failure and then the financial seat changes and try to stick with the glide path that we lock ourselves into, and it makes it a larger number for the city, makes it less palatable. Take the jump that you want to take now, but leave it open for us to say, now, not we may increase it over the next fiscal year, rather than saying, we are, as a matter of possibility, this each and every year going forward, and maybe circumstances change, and we're saying, I wish we would have been able to take a bigger chunk or a smaller chunk.
That one's kind of already done now. This year studies 7.5, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Rather than make a motion, we were going to do X every single year for the next 5 years.
We don't have to make that motion.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I would prefer to just decide what we're going to do one chunk at a time.
We decided last year we went 7.85 for the current valuation. For the upcoming one, we already know it's 7.75. We can leave it as it is.
It could be a May meeting topic every year.
Right.
Okay, effective 10-1 of whatever year we're in, do we want to lower it?
Again, how much? We've already put the ball in motion to lower that point one from last year to this coming year. Next year.
The only thing that doing is 3 year, like, and I see what Steve's got written on this thing, 10th this year, 10th next year, and half a 10th in the third year, is it takes the knee-jerking way. You know you're going to do it. So if you're sitting on that fence next year going, should we, you've kind of committed yourself to doing something where you're not second-guessing yourself next year.
Well, and also, I don't know if the FRS, if they're watching and they see that we're making a conscious effort to keep it in line on our own without them having to come up. We're policing ourselves,
What I wrote down was on my paper was we're at 7.75, taking it to 7.65, 7.55, and 7.50 over a 3 year period is what I have down on paper. And I think obviously that can change at any point during this entire process. If you want to stop it or reverse course, that can be done. But right now,
we can do it 1 year or 3 year.
Motion.
Okay, whoever wants to make a motion and what motion they want to make.
I got some numbers written down, so I'll go ahead and start. I'll make a motion that we make an incremental reduction in the assumption rate. We know October 1 of 19 is going to be at 7.75. That means in 20 it would be at 7.65. No. In October of 1.
October 2018 is 7.75.
Okay.
So 7.85. No,
7.185 is 7.85.
But
the
19
is
going to
be.
With the 10.19 valuation, we're set to lower at the 7.75.
That's the valuation as of the values of 9.30.
So on 10.19, it would go to 7.65.
That's what is proposed.
Yes.
All right, so 10.1 of 19, so we go to 7.65. 10.1 of 20, 7.55. And then 10.1 of 2021, 7.50.
So your motion is a year?
Yes. The first 2 years reduced it by 10% than the last year.
Motion in a second. Over discussion.
Look, does dropping at 20 on this past year to next year?
No. Because
we're at 7.85, so if the proposal we just say we lower it to 7.65 with the next valuation.
Where was he in the 7.75 we're currently at? We are currently at 7.75.
This now value. Right, but the valuation still is at 7.85.
Because it's for the time period ending 9.30.
We're not set, coming into this meeting, we're not set to lower it until 10.1.19 report to 7.75.
That is not what we voted 2 years ago. That is not what we voted. We voted to take it from 8 to 7.85, the big chunk the first year, and 7.75 the second year, which is what we voted in. If they'll go back in minutes, they'll find it.
That might be true. I had notes that it was 7.7. It was skip a year and then go 7.85, skip a year, 7.75. So,
we notified the state last year, we notified them this morning from 8 to 7.85, and then October 1st, 7.75.
You can still modify, and even though it's still a 7.85, the discussion here is we're resuming your glide path. So you can make it 7.65 with next year's report. It would just be going from 7.85 to 7.65 instead of 7.75 to 7.65. My guesstimation is it would be about 2% of payroll, but based on the way payroll's been growing, I think you're going to more than
I don't understand how we're skipping what the board voted on. That's what I'm not
understanding. Because I had notes for 7.75 with next year, not with this year's report.
And the city's already contributed this year's as of October 1. And we've given
them. The report we just approved, I could redo, but then you'd have to resubmit the GASB for CAFR.
CAFR.
And that's probably closed at this point.
Okay. State report for the final two.
But it's fine. There's really no harm or foul because you're just implementing a policy which has a lot of range. You have a lot of leeway.
Right.
The state's already approved you, and it's probably not in another cycle for 2 years. And payroll's continuing to grow.
Motion by second, but it's a lot bigger chunk of money now.
It's about an extra 1% of payroll, but the way payroll is growing, it's going to be absorbed. And the payroll reduction this last year was over 6%. So we're talking about a 1% of payroll give back, but it's going to be absorbed.
Do you want to amend the motion to take the 0.5%
first, or the 5 basis points first, and then the 1 and 1.
I think that would be a different motion. I think we would need to vote on this one and make a decision before we would draw another motion.
So we're still in discussion about whether that's...
Or withdraw the motion entirely.
All right, so I'll withdraw my motion. For further consideration. That's the language you're talking about.
I get where you're going.
I know where you're going. You're gonna go...
Okay.
7 point, you go from, it'll go to 7.70. 7 point...
No, the 7.75 never gonna exist. It's gonna be to go to
7.75
because he had notes that it skipped a year. So we only ever made it to 7.85.
So if we take it at 7.70, then 7.6 and 7.5. So you're taking a 0.15 the first year.
You were about to hit
0.10.
Yeah, right. Not richer than what they actually turned out to be that way. And now we're under that, we can go 1.5.
That would get us to 7.5 in 3 years. If we're looking at the 7.85 as our number. So we would be talking about a October 1, reducing our rate to 7.70. So we go from 7.85 to 7.70.
And then 6.
And then 6 and then 5.
Over 3 years, just one bigger chunk in the beginning.
And then we do nothing, next year's October 1 reports will be 7.75.
Correct.
That's what's our problem.
Correct. Right. So we're just talking about reducing it in half.
Okay.
Of what we think.
See, that's what I'm not understanding. But now we've gone back to using the 7.85. What number do we need to use as a basis to start this October? 7.85?
That's what it is right now.
That's where we are on this year's valuation.
10-1 of 2019, what number will we be at? If we make no changes?
7.75.
7.75? So the motion that we're making, we're already at 7.75. Would be Steve's original motion for the next 3 years after that. Right?
If we waited until the November meeting.
Well, you just make the motion now and we'll just change what that did to October of this year.
Or we can decide to accelerate this because we know October 1 of 19 is going to be a 7.75. Instead of being a 7.75, we can tell that it's going to be a 7.70. And then we go 7.6 to 7.5, and within 3 years, we'll have it at 7.75.
I think that's a good idea.
Yep.
Thank you.
Let's make Brian make this.
Oh, you wrote it down.
It's his idea. All right, I'll make a motion that come October 1, 2019, we take the assumption rate to 7.70. October 1 of 2020, 7.60. And October 1 of 2021, 7.50.
You have a motion.
Second.
Have a second.
Wait,
I'm done. All in favor.
Wait, the markets aren't going to give you that. But the markets aren't going to give you that. I forgot to tell you that.
Opposed.
Call these UBS people up. Don't lever that fund up a little bit. We need a little more return.
All right. Back to the RFP.
Can we do the update on the social
media? Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
Let's
do the update on that.
Let's see, where I start. As you know, we set up a demo for April 26th to see Neihardt, Milliman, and Foster's software, retention software, retirement software, Mr. Tucker was there with us.
Sure was.
All three plans can do what we need them to do. Adding, subtracting, this, that, and the other. With Foster being the actuary, I would say that that's the suit we follow with the software. I'd say actuary is the software.
Tell them what got us to this point.
Why
we need the software. You and I have discussed it, the board hasn't heard it.
Yeah, sorry.
They've not heard from Winsome, but part of what got us here is the city has changed some of their software over the years, and it becomes increasingly difficult to get historical data, historical salaries, and so on. I think I'm kind of correct. That's part of what got us.
Yes, that's correct.
That's part of what got us where we are.
Someone will have one. We can't retain pensionable wages.
Yes.
Without a lot of manual process.
Yes, because the embedded is in like several different systems, so it's very time consuming to go and pull that information out. And there are even some data that Felicia has on paper that is in none of the systems. You know, so as the years go by, things are basically getting worse. You know, so it's important now that we have a software where we can get all of our data as much as possible in the system. Foster and Foster already have the majority of our data. So when we look at converting data, there really isn't much to do, you know, because throughout the years they have kept all of the data that Alicia have given them. And the ones that Alicia has on paper or on microfiche someplace, and those can be manually entered into the system. You know, so at the time when Alicia decide that she's going to retire, I don't have to worry about how somebody's going to calculate my three different, because I'm one of the fortunate ones who's on the three different things.
So my question to you is, what happens in 5 years when the city says, oh, you know, this just doesn't work, we want another phone for, and
where the payroll system is concerned, because by then, all of the data would be in if we decide to go to Foster and Foster, would be in Foster.
That's where I was looking.
Yes, before. And every 2 weeks we'll be feeding data into that system to keep it updated.
What would happen if we went with Foster and Foster,
mm-hmm.
and for whatever reason, 5 years down the road, they say, we want to go to Milton. What's going to happen to all that data? Does it belong to us or does it belong to Foster?
It belongs to us. So we will ask Foster and Foster to give us our data. And they may charge us a little bit, you know, to extract it into us, but the data.
Yeah, it's common in our line of work. Data transfers from one firm to another or mm-hmm. one entity to another. We have all the fiscal year salaries going back as long as it's been a client.
Part of our problem would be to do an estimate for somebody. Alicia's got to go to three or four places and go to the basement and dig through old payroll records
mm-hmm.
to find what somebody's salary was. You've been here 25 years to find out what you made.
And you don't have a worker's comp or any of those things. So, my
first year, $20,394.57.
So, but if this software program, that will change. Does that mean somebody's gonna go down in the basement and put all that stuff in? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, whatever data that Foster and Foster
and you do not have an assistant.
Right.
Then we will basically get that data either on a spreadsheet and import it in or manually enter those.
And
that is no longer, that is not.
I don't know that we necessarily have to go backwards for too many people.
Okay.
But looking forward.
Yeah, yeah.
Because about every 10 years, the city changes their financial system. And we lose that information to do those calculations. So like I said, there are some instances where we have to go to the city clerk's office to get wages, W-2s, printed. Those will go away eventually, but so will even.
Yeah, yeah.
At a past.
What's happened before the new software, the city's gotten lost, not compatible with the old. And you couldn't go back and retrieve the old stuff.
Well, but, so stuff you're going to put into the newest financial system is not automatically, is it automatically going to be duplicated into Foster? Or you'll be able, I mean, what I'm saying is whatever the latest financial thing is right now, you know, in 10 years, when you change it, is it all going to transfer, keep transferring so that you won't have to go back down to the basement or do whatever?
Yeah, it will continue to be transferred because hopefully I understand what you just said. And with what they have, and once you decide, okay, we're going to go with them, then bi-weekly we're going to be feeding them our payroll data.
Okay. And that was my question.
Yes.
Is that this, so we don't have to backtrack. It's going
correct.
To be current, it's going to stay current.
Yes.
So that 10 years when you say, somebody says, yeah, this just doesn't work.
Exactly.
Are we going to do this all over again? Mm-hmm. No, it will be caught up to the same point as the financial.
Yes.
And that's what I was, thank you, you did get it.
The other side of that is the system doing the actual calculation, having and knowing all of the nuances for the plan,
right.
So that someone can be trained in a short amount of time how to do calculations.
Right.
Unlike us having to know now, well, this exception, that exception.
Got it.
Then
yeah.
Working this plan, that plan, there's two plans, that kind of thing. That are the main selling points.
Sure.
And then there's others. Employees will be able to use it. When I understand, only about 30% of the employees actually use the online capabilities. That might get used more as the younger child continues to get hired.
In a lot of ways,
it'll be dependent
on how well we study those personnel and how well
we're
going to get
more computers out of
them.
What's that?
Yeah. When I sat through the three presentations,
but this could be a way to get them a little bit more involved.
Mm-hmm.
Just to touch on each of the three of them, the Milliman one was not very easy to look at and navigate. It was going to be. I can see where there's very quickly there's going to be frustration by my cops that are using it to go.
Right.
Neihardt and Foster both had systems that were much more user friendly. Neihardt maybe had a little bit more towards financial planning type stuff. I think Foster kind of stuck towards these are your numbers, this is what your calculation would be. But it was very easy to navigate it with like on the screen through the Foster system, which was good.
Yeah, one of the key points that I pointed out in the demo was when you signed on, you put your password in, your normal calculation of the opening sheet that we get, that calculation came up. It said, this is your normal retirement. If you stay, this is what it is. If you leave now, you'll be vested in draw this date, and this is what it is. So you didn't actually have to key anything in except for your user ID and password to at least have the normal just come up.
And that introduction page will be fluid as you updated every
it is
whatever.
What the employees are used to seeing every year from us anyways.
So the only thing I don't know is, and I didn't get this, I got a general idea of the cost for Milliman and Neihardt, but I don't know what Foster's cost was. That wasn't.
Yeah, I think that.
I was there.
In total annually, I just wrote down the annual total. It was $45,000 for all three to switch over to.
For all three plans?
Mm-hmm. Annually.
So was Nyhard, did Nyhard factor in all three plans, or were they just?
They did, they factored in, and they came in a lot lower, it was $32,000.
Right.
But then at the same time, so, you know, there were additional, you know, like calculation that we would have to pay for, that was unfactored, and so, into the $32,000.
That was true.
And as you mentioned earlier today, like the cost and the cost of some of the costs that we're currently paying.
With this plan, they don't really do final calculations through Foster, so this plan wouldn't have the cost savings that fire in general would eventually down the road.
Our fire.
Should be paid for especially.
Our fire calculation was done by their actuary.
Finals, yes.
The finals.
The finals are both reviewed by the general and the fire department actuary. But there is a cost.
Well, we do our own using the simple provided by the. Occasionally we'll have special things for them. You go back and refresh my memory. Element was 30-something thousand dollars.
It was 30 for the implementation and 44 for the annual.
What was?
I would have write it down. 34 and then 4,500 basically,
yes.
A year.
34?
30 and 44.
30. And
Foster was 35 and 45.
4,500?
A year.
A year?
Yeah, you missed that.
For all?
Three plans.
All three combined.
Which makes our part.
I
want our part.
Your part is.
Your part is 10 to implement.
That's what I'm. And if all three plans
go
together, we knock off 10%. So 10 to implement, 13.5 annually. That's police. And our part of Milliman was. What to implement and what annually?
I had 14,000 for all three. They did not split it like Foster did. Each one didn't have its own individual. It was just a joint with all three. It was.
So if Milliman was going to be 30,000 for the entire city, all three plants to implement.
To implement.
And then $4,500 a year.
45,000. That's why it's 13,000. Third plan.
So the city's paying for how much of this? Because they want it?
Well, I haven't had that discussion with my boss yet. I'm sure we will.
In the very beginning, we were told that the city's going to be a big input.
Well, I am sure the city will pick up a part of the cost because it's to our advantage that we get it.
Well, if the board approves and determines it's a reasonable pension expense, we build the board. Pay us in a trust fund. The city reimburses that following evaluation. It means the city pays 100%.
No, I'm not. It doesn't matter what one. When it was originally Milliman, and maybe Nyhard does this, and I think maybe Foster does this, we were told the city was kicking for this plan. Were we not?
And that
this was going to be. This was going to be city.
For the implementation.
When we were talking about just Millman, the city wants this, so the city's gonna pay, I think it was 25% of it. And the other three boards were gonna pay for the other 25%, wasn't that?
I don't know if it was decided, or what.
I don't know, but.
I don't think it was any real strong discussion.
Yeah, but I'm sure that in the city will pick up whatever they need to for us to get this all cleared. Because we definitely need to have something in place.
Yeah, because I remember having the discussion about splitting it, and you, Mike, wanted it split with the percentages that the administrative plan was.
Yes, and.
And I said I didn't know how that was gonna happen, that the city is definitely interested in making this work.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that we got and that does need to be the discussion as to move forward.
What did the general board decide?
The general board, approved going with Foster.
On a share basis.
However, the other plans wanted to split that.
Doug, you just gave us a figure, so here's what initial cost would be the police and the annual cost of police. How did you guys determine that? Did you just take a figure divided by three, or did you do a basic?
No, it's the complexity, and the general plan's a lot more complex. So we did a higher number for them, police and fire were the same.
See, in our discussion 2 meetings ago was that we were gonna have to pay a higher share probably because we were gonna have more people than that.
Yeah, and you'll see that in the administrative agreement. Your number of employees went up and overall, and the number in general went down, so your percentage went up.
And I have a problem. I want to know what the city is going to do, and I'll tell you why I want to know what the city is going to do. Because the last time we were deciding stuff, and for several years while we were deciding stuff, we were hearing and we were getting negotiated at by the city about pension costs.
Right,
and
that
man just
over
the head. It wasn't just that man. It wasn't just that man. It was. That's what they're constantly beating us over. Is fees. You've seen it for years. Every time they take a stab at the pension plans, it's about what we're spending all this money for. What? For what? For what? For what? That's where I have a problem not knowing anything.
Well, I'm meeting with Bill tomorrow, and I'll have the discussion, and because for the first year, the Foster and Foster, you know, that was the total.
For the general, it was 18,000.
No, 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 overall.
Overall,
yeah.
Overall implementation was 35,
mm-hmm.
And annually it was 45.
Well,
if everybody signed on.
Okay, so the first year. Okay.
Yes.
So I find out how much of the city's going to pick up.
We can decide who we think is the best option to go with. We're going to say, okay, these are the costs involved, and we'd like the city to come back and tell us. What portion of this are they looking to absorb of this cost? I can tell you, I can certainly tell you, I don't think you're going to be satisfied. They may like the Milliman stuff at the end of the day, but we're not going to like the way that looks when we look at it cop-wise. And we try to run computations on our own. If I had to give you a recommendation, it would definitely be Foster over that for sure. I think they're happy with going with Foster as well, if I understand. Way they look at it as well. They would be more pleased if we went Foster. We've had a long relationship with Foster, so I don't have a problem with that. Their cost is involved. I have concerns about NIHARD simply because of, in talking with Alicia, there was a lot of changes and things that were going on last fall with NIHARD. Some real uncertainty with the fire pension where they were looking at it, where they're even looking at the point of leaving NIHARD and potentially going to Foster.
Now, they have, I have to give credit to Heath and his staff. Since they changed consultants, they have stepped up. They have tried to bend over backwards to vote what happens if he's not there, and I don't know exactly what all of the issues were, but I didn't deal directly with Randy, did most of the direct.
Is, are we still in the position where the fire department is waiting for some decisions by other boards to make their decision?
They're waiting for a decision as to what software, because they also want to follow suit. They have, if we're gonna have software, we'd like it to be with.
Right.
So the splits in what this board will pay for is contingent upon outside of any company. What the city, if the city picks up anything, and whatever formula that vendor uses to decide.
Yeah, they're all different.
But the, as of right now, yours would be $10,000 on the startup for police, and then 13.5-ish a year, depending on what number of employees.
Flat. The number of employees goes up, it's still the same. 13.5.
And that's the software that they need to do what they do, and that also includes the programs for the employees to log on and do their own estimates.
They can do their estimates as many times as they want, they're not bugging you. The green sheets that we send out every year goes on to every employee has their own little page. Their green sheets will be up there, their beneficiary forms will be on there. So they can see, oh, I forgot to change it, got remarried, whatever. It'll be a track of all of the different estimates they've run. Also, management and administrator can see how many estimates they've run. It's a pretty useful tool. It allows the members in their own privacy to run the estimates without coming to you and Alicia and Jessica and requesting all these and all the time involved with collecting the data, submitting it back. As long as we're getting payroll every 2 weeks or so, we're keeping it managed and up to date.
What mechanism would have to be put in place? Alicia mentioned a few minutes ago about workers' comp. Because if somebody's out on extended workers' comp and they have lost time, then that affects their credit and service, which means your data would have to be updated. Yeah. Likewise, I get periodic disciplinary updates when people get substantial suspensions and it's lost credit and service.
Well, we would have to be full of breaks in service. As far as the pay is fluctuating, we're always calculating the highest 5 average, no matter what. Breaks in service, we have to be told. If we're fed that information along with payroll, then we can incorporate that. Mm-hmm.
Right,
I'm
wondering that workers' comp report. I'm sure something like that can create and upload when we upload the
payroll.
Everything we do right now, a lot of that's done manually.
All
the disciplinary stuff is done manually.
Yeah, we're just fed break dates. We can easily incorporate that so a member gets on and says, oh, I've been out of work for 3 weeks or last 2 months. I want to do an estimate. It will account for it.
Yeah, we code workers' comp, MC, workers' comp, legal, UL, on off cover. Even without pay, suspension, we code all those in a different code in our payroll system. So it's just extracting it.
And as long as we're told what the key is, then we can program accordingly.
No, I never did hear the cost for my ordinance. What was my heart? Like the implementation and the yearly.
They were another one that did her plan. It was a little bit more than the cost.
I'm fine, it's just total.
Total is 30 and 32. That is if they got all three plans.
What,
all of them. All of the numbers I gave you.
All of them.
One thing I don't know if you factor that in, you have, that you have to consider is you have one company that's doing our actuarial work.
Yeah.
Somebody else that's doing the software work.
So what are we being asked to decide? What company to end the negotiation with? Or are we hiring? Or what are we being asked to decide during that? Because it says report. And are we, what decision, are you looking for a decision on which way to go?
Yes.
I think I'm comfortable being involved with giving a decision, but there's particulars that we would like to know about before final approval. I can sit here and say, I would like to give my business to Foster's, but I would like to know how much the city is paying and so forth. But I, before we say, yes, let's go forward and move with it. I have that responsibility to our membership, and I cross line and everything else.
If we vote to say, okay, Foster's, we're committed. And then the city comes back and says, we're not paying for any of this.
Correct.
We don't need it.
At the same point.
It would make it easier for them.
Right, no. I'm just gonna take it back to what Doug said. You know, he's gonna invoice the board, and then the board's gonna pay it, and then the city's gonna reimburse the administration. That's the general support of it. No matter how much the city says they're paying on the invoice, at the end of the day, the city will take the bill.
The city has to back. Yep. Which is exactly what we can go back to them and say this is the software that we implemented that you supported. Okay, and there have been many other things that were implemented that were supported, and it's still whatever the home office says. I don't, you can tell me all you want to. I'm telling you the fact of what's been going on for 10 years that I've been sitting on this board, from the state legislature, from the city in negotiations, and from everybody else. When they want to attack a pension plan, they attack it about, oh, it's overbloated this, and then they let the members stack their money here, and then it's, and look at the fees that they pay. They just throw money down the tube for no reason whatsoever, other, whatever. And consultants are getting rich, and they're just putting that money here and there, and we got to stop them. They're rogues. And people in this city have done that and said that.
And use that as a basis for reducing benefits.
So I'm fine with working with the city, but I want to know what playing field I'm on from the get-go.
So
that's my opinion.
So then I guess this needs to be tabled yet again until you come back at the meeting with Mr. Kaufman. I mean, you know what the numbers are, the startup and the end.
I mean, I'll pass a motion. I would be willing to support a motion with a contingency built into it that we're not committed to crap, depending on what happens. Because ultimately, our loyalty, our money is not ours to spend. It's, we owe it to them not to enter into a bad deal.
But I also think that also, because it would be to the benefit also of the pension board that we have the data in one system. That way, for those people who have been here 30, 40 years,
we have very few of them,
and they're getting ready to retire. Well, maybe not right now, but you're hiring younger people, and they may stay here. You know, we want to have a system in place that can track the changes without us having to go back to paper, you know, without us having to rely upon somebody's memory. You know, to me, having a system that you can have all your data in is more efficient than the way that we're currently doing it.
I don't think anybody would disagree with that statement. I think we all agree with that statement.
And so I got into a little bit further. So even if the city says, well, we only pick up 20,000 in the long run, it's gonna benefit all three claimants.
I don't want to stray too far from the topic because we're going to get your plan today, but what's the thought process behind us being billed 100% and reimbursed by the city? Why is that being washed through pension?
Ultimately, the city is responsible for making the plan whole and providing the benefit. So if we come up short on investments, or we come up short on contributions from whatever the source is, the city has to make that up.
Right, but I guess to your point that we're going to get bang on paper for, we pay all of these identity administrative fees, which are actually, in fact, being under the city. Why is all of that coming through our conference? Why are we not entering into some sort of proposal where the pension actually pays whatever its actual portion is, and the city writes a check separate to that to avoid that very issue? That it just makes, I'm coming to be a very young face to full development, but
because the city, and I can't speak for anybody with the city could take the approach of none of that's our responsibility, that's all pension issues, it's all about being born by the pension, which is the position they've taken for years.
Oh, yeah. The boards ultimately pay for everything, per salary and per salary.
The three boards pay on a prorated basis.
By the number of people per plan. Everything's paid for by us, I guess.
Plus,
the members give their money. The state gives its money, the city is responsible for the rest.
But again, you understand my question from a billing standpoint. Mm-hmm. We're being asked to enter into this instead of allegedly that benefit both parties. Some perhaps even more than others, depending on what side of the fence you're on. But for whatever reason, we're going to wash the entire cost through the accounts of the pension board. Mm-hmm. So the pension board is going to write one great big check and just we're going to be reimbursed by the city, but still on our data sheet, it's going to show that this giant expense.
Absolutely.
I don't understand why that has to be. It's showing who's actually paying.
Because then they turn around and look at that spreadsheet that shows what we pay and go, that's why you're not viable, we should run you.
No, I agree with that, but that's what I'm saying in reality, why we don't actually independently pay whatever costs. That's what I'm saying. Why does it have to be that it comes all through our account, because that seems to be the root of the problem.
And I don't think that's all been decided yet how it's going to be done. So I think that's part of the negotiation.
You guys were there and you studied all this and you've looked at all the facts and the figures. Do you have a recommendation on which way to go? One you like better than the other?
I support Foster & Foster. And for one of the big reasons is the fact that they already have our data. You know, and if we go with another company, all the data that Boston Foster has, we're going to probably have to beg them to give it to us, because a lot of that is not all in one system. So the conversion alone would be crazy. You know, so to me, that's one of the big advantage of going with Foster & Foster.
One of the questions, Doug, the initial cost is $35,000 for all three plans. Mm-hmm. It's $45,000 for all three plans per year. What's the recurring income cost? Assuming that the initial cost is a one-time only cost, is it $45,000
per
year?
All right.
Yes. With a guarantee for 3 years? 5 years.
We haven't really talked about guarantees until we think we need a raise and the board approves it. So the guarantee is forever until we come to some mutual agreement otherwise.
So you're looking at initially a cost of $80,000
for the first year? No.
The initial cost plus the that's for the whole shebang.
Yes, for the first year.
Right. And then $45,000 thereafter,
right,
until it's negotiated to get a new rate.
Yes.
So who's going to negotiate this? What's the plan for who's going to negotiate this? Because we negotiate,
they negotiate, they negotiate, the city negotiates, who's gonna be the lead in this? Who's gonna be the one that negotiates? Who's gonna be the one that sits across the table like we did a couple of years ago when we were deciding something and I went, no, come on, do better. And you did better. Who's gonna be that person when every board is a separate entity?
I'll be the person on.
On your side, on your side, but how does it, and I'm asking a question from, this makes, because when we hire a manager, it's this board hiring them. When fire does, it's that board. Is each board collectively hiring them, or is the city hiring them? Because I don't think anybody's thought about that either. Who's the contract with? Because the boards are separate entities.
I imagine it would look kind of like the administrative agreement. The city signed off on it, and all three boards signed off on it.
We signed off for our part?
Yes.
Okay, but who negotiated? I mean, with that, there's no negotiation because we know what you're getting paid. We know what you're getting paid. It's a set thing. This is something that could change. What if we bought
the board?
What if we bought and fire says, oh, give W's, you know, say they come back in 5 years and they go, we want 5,000 more per board. What happens when whoever's sitting in this chair says, absolutely not? And the board actually goes, absolutely not. We're not paying that. It's not worth it. I can look at my last paycheck and figure it out, or whatever.
That's what I think it almost supports Lenny's idea that a separate contractual type agreement signed off by each chair of each board, and it answers all of those questions of what you're speaking about.
Because then you also have, God help it ever happen, their system screws up something, but it ends up just being us, or something. And I'm not saying it would, but you know what I'm saying? If we have an issue there, is everybody suing them? Is nobody suing them? Is the police board suing them? Is the individual officer who got messed up suing them? Who sues?
Who gets sued?
Huh?
The question is, who gets sued?
That too.
The board gets sued, or does the city get sued?
Oh, probably. That's how it works these days.
No, it's in
Wisconsin.
Yeah, right.
I think there's really a lot of questions that are left unanswered. Who would Foster prefer the contract to be with? Each board or one contract with the city?
The board. We contract at all. We work the board, not the city.
Doug, if they had a third party plan administrator, if it wasn't the city doing the plan administrator, they had an independent third-party plan administrator, wouldn't that plan administrator be the one contracting with the Millerons or you guys?
No, the board. I mean, the plan administrator would facilitate it and operate on behalf of the board. But the board ultimately is the plan administrator.
So the plan administrator needs certain tools to do their job.
Yeah.
This looks like a tool to do their job. And we come into play with the board, maybe I shouldn't even talk, I'm not a board member, but it seems confusing to me that the boards are having to make a decision to hire a software package that the plan administrator needs to do their job. In other words, it seems like the plan administrator would be doing the negotiations and, hey, we like this software package, and then it's part of the plan administrator's contract with you all. You know, maybe they have to ask for a raise because they incorporated this software package. But it seems like that's the entity that's dealing with this part of it. What am I missing?
Would there be three contracts? One with each board? For this software package?
This type of discussion is fairly new because for our 40-year existence, we've always engaged with pension boards for all of our work.
I mean, we have a separate contract with you for our actuarial services. Would that just be an extension of that service?
I Yes.
But you're asking the board to spend additional money for a service that they're already getting that makes your job harder if you don't get it. But it isn't costing the board $30,000 a year. So why would, I'm really getting out of my element here, but why would the board want to approve $30,000 a year that they don't have to pay now?
So that the board has the tools to do the proper calculations if Dale or I leave. Anybody can come in and sit down and do the calculations if Dale or I leave and not have to worry about where's workers' comp caught, was someone's suspension caught, did they get both pensions, did they have a general, a fire? Are the wages right?
Honestly.
Been audited in there and done?
It's not.
I think the city should bear the entire cost for all of it.
Benefit calculations have to be done for the members.
Fortunately. I'm not thinking crazy, am I?
I think the city should pay it all. And if they think we should pay more, then they should incorporate it into this administrative agreement. But our administrative agreement is already to provide some of these services. And it should be, the city should pay for all of it.
Well, that gets to Lenny's question. Why then would the expense be run through the board?
Right.
And shown up as an additional expense to the board? Now, if the plan administrator, by contract, wants to pass on some of those costs to the board, that's a whole different discussion, right? Related.
That's a negotiation to that document.
I think it should be passed on to the board through that document. That's kind of where I was going.
Yeah, that's not.
And I probably made some mistakes. I was going to understand the whole.
No, that's what I was trying to say. Maybe I just.
But this is a contract between the city and the board.
So the city.
You want the contract to go between the board and the actuary.
Well, I can pass back to the CEO if he has any problem tracking with some other entity than the board. I can ask that question.
This is a new undertaking, even for you guys. Y'all do this one in the other cities?
Yeah, this is the first year we've really been rolling it out, but it's taking off really well. Yeah, but thus far, it's been with pension boards.
But you would sign three separate contracts with three separate boards at the city of Ocala to offer that service, that service for everybody. So anybody from the three plans, but the contract would be us, fire, the separate documents, if I'm understanding.
Yeah. Although I understand doing it that way, there's some risk to the board, or really the membership. City manager turns over and they look at their contracts like, we don't need this anymore. Next thing you know, it's been pulled out from the plan membership. And right now, if we can track with the board has control over that service.
I almost wondered if that's not a
legal
question.
You could definitely have a contract with us right here or something like that. If the administrator pulled out, we have the right to assume.
We should probably work out a legal counsel for you before we tackle this.
I guess I almost feel like if we do it the way it is proposed, we're essentially making a straw man purchase. We're going to run everything through the board, and the city's going to pay us 100% for it. So in essence, the city just purchased a good or a service with their own money, and they ran through us. I think they would like.
That's really the entire pension plan.
You understand what I'm saying? I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn last night, and you know, I don't know anything else but you need. That sounds very much to me, and I would like a legal opinion on that if we were to move forward with that.
We should get Paul Scott.
Paul Scott, right now,
they're looking at the thing.
We should have this.
Yes, we can. Yeah, 30 minutes.
I'm thinking we're pretty much done for today. Is there anybody who wants to make a motion to move forward with anything at this point.
Would there be something like?
Talk about the RFPs, right? Or is that over? Did we miss that?
No, I'm talking about, no, I'm not talking about the RFPs. I'm talking about for the.
Software.
The software. I think there's too many questions.
Would there be anything along the same line towards Foster and Foster, and that gives you some information to go back to the other boards and say, leaning towards Foster, but we got a lot of detail to work on.
That's Monday. I mean, yes, I get exactly what you're saying, but again, who's negotiating it at this point? Me?
I think it comes back to your original question, to Alicia, was what are you looking, what are you looking for from us today? Was it just an indication of who you would go with out of these three if everything else was worked out, or?
Would your support be for Foster? And if so, what does that support look like? So we need to take it back to management and the other boards.
This would be Tad Mounds making a motion that we're going to enter into a contract negotiation at very least with Foster.
I guess at this point, Dad can speak with Christensen, see where we can go, how we should go. And then we can table the next meeting. And that's when I'll look for the file. If they ask if it was tabled, because of questions, that's what I'm asking.
How much work has to be done to get this thing up and running? Obviously, it's something tailored to all three of our plans, but as you said, it is extremely complicated. We have a target date for implementation.
We don't. I can get that information. I can request.
Is this your project or someone else?
No, we've got a team, but I can take that request back and say how long from data up and running would it take? What do we need if there's anything additional? We've got payroll for fiscal 18, so it's just a matter of getting payroll from them as well now as part of it. So I'll ask back and get that information for you.
I think in some of the, doing the demos, it was 8 to 9 months.
It's in that time frame.
Then it.
Yeah, certainly no limit to that long.
At least, yes.
So you're looking at the first of the year or even later.
Yeah.
Out of the year.
We are probably looking a little bit later, just because we're also implementing a payroll financial package as well.
It could be sped up a little bit, just because Foster already has information to the three plans already.
Understand, it's not that I'm trying to be difficult, it's I'm trying to protect this plan and do what I'm supposed to be doing as a trustee. Not, okay. I just don't want to, but I know where the wind blows. All right, so we'll table the matter. We'll table the matter. It's tabled. So we have some more answers. RFP, let's get it.
And now, earlier in the meeting, it was decided to wait to see what the other board would do.
Well, I mean, just a review. Anyway, yes.
Thank you.
Does anybody want to review this and ask any questions, or do you want to take it home and review it, and we'll discuss it at the next meeting once we know what was decided earlier about what the other, where the other boards were looking?
Which doctor?
Yes.
I will take the time to read it, but basically those leads are either in the same for.
Yeah, one of these is like 20-something pages.
Okay.
And the other one is 16 or 18. I did it as part of a 10 pages or more is their liability insurance coverage.
And you're going to let me know when General's special meeting is so I can come in and come to your meeting? Thank you.
These are administrative agreements. The contract is up in October, so I want to give everyone some time to look at it and we can discuss it in the August meeting.
Other matters?
No, the thing that I spoke with you about in the very beginning and mentioned it way early on in this meeting, this marathon meeting. Well, this is things that the board's already taken action on.
Yes.
On a piecemeal basis.
Yes.
And this is something we don't need to have to take action on today.
It's just putting it in a modified service agreement.
And once Brad signs it and sends it on.
We're getting ready to send it out in mail to you. Just need your signature and then we'll be done.
What this is just an addendum to our agreement with Foster on fees that we've already approved on a piecemeal basis over the years as changes have come about. Partly due to some of those state mandated gas fee and all those kind of things.
You have nothing else? Meeting adjourned, 4:45.